Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let's move on to another attack ad because it's that season. Just like you have the holidays, you have attack ad season, and we're deep in it. So you've got Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Harold Ford Jr. He went to a party at the, you know, Playboy Mansion, a 2005 Playboy Super Bowl party. I don't know if it was actually at the mansion, but it was a Playboy party. And he said, I like football and I like girls. I don't want to apologize. But now there's a Republican National Committee ad condemning his ways. Let's take a listen.
So what kind of man parties with Playboy playmates in lingerie, then films political ads from a church pew? What kind of man is Harold Ford? The National Republican Senatorial Committee is responsible for the content of this ad.
Yvonne, should women be offended? Should men be offended? Should everyone be offended by Harold Ford? Or should people be offended by the ad, which has overtones of, you know, miscegenation, you know, a blonde woman and talking about Harold. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism that this might be more of a racial attack than a sexual attack.
Harold Ford should be ashamed of Harold Ford. At this point, throughout his career, he has been very careful in terms of sculpting his image as well as his political message, and to try and at least appear that he was in the mainstream of the political spectrum. I think that there was no way that he should have not understood the political ramifications of him appearing at a party associated with Playboy. Now, as a private citizen, you know, whether or not that's his right, you know, that's his business. But he is not a public, a private citizen. He's running for a high political office. So certainly there are people in the South and in other parts of the country that do buy into the whole racial undertones of seeing some blonde woman talking about Harold Ford, and they can read into it what they will. I think that Harold Ford has no one to blame but Harold Ford for whatever comes out of this debacle. And that's it. I mean, I think in this day and age it's unfortunate, but those feelings, those racial feelings still exist. And he opened a door for his opponent to attack him rightly or wrongly.
Walter, he made his bed, he's lying in it. Is that how you feel?
Not necessarily. I think many Americans are growing to the point that they want to keep politics out of the bedroom. You know, and I think what we're seeing here is the morality play that really isn't working for the Republican Party this election cycle. I'm surprised they used it in Tennessee. That's my shock. Given all the skeletons in the GOP closet this year, I think it was a strategic mistake to even roll this ad out, because I think it gives Harold Ford, despite what you may think of his personal preferences and choices, I think it gives him another weapon to use against the Republican Party at a time when the state of Tennessee is facing some serious issues. This is the best that the Republicans can come up with, that he went to a Playboy party at a Super Bowl. So I think most voters will look at this, including some Republicans, and say, you've got to be kidding me. There are more substantive issues to talk about and better things to do with airtime than running an ad like this, or the one that runs on TV where you have a blonde sort of winking at him saying, call me Harold. I mean, it's really juvenile politics at its worst.
Ron, is this a bad ad, or is this a strategic and powerful ad?
I don't think it's a bad ad. I agree with what my colleague said earlier. When you run for public office and you put yourself in the public light, if you film political television spots where you're in a church and you hold yourself out to high moral values and high moral character, and then you attend a party in Jacksonville, Florida, a Super Bowl party hosted by Playboy magazine, I think that if you're an official in the public light, it allows certain individuals to criticize or to question your morality choices. But looking at the broader racial overtones, I think this is a tempest in a teapot and much ado about nothing. To suggest that a blonde woman saying, I met Harold Ford at a Playboy party somehow has racial overtones or is racist, which has been so much of the discourse for the last couple days, I think is ridiculous. In my opinion, it is equally racist to suggest that if a particular person who is Caucasian says I met Harold Ford at a party is racist, are individuals then saying that it should have been a African-American woman saying that or a Hispanic woman? I think this is much ado about nothing, but right or wrong, Mr. Ford has put himself in the crosshairs by holding himself up to be a strong moral character and then attending that party, and a Playboy party, and then allowing his opponents the opportunity to criticize him.
I just want to add one thing. I think that's a complete misunderstanding of U.S. history, particularly in the South. The notion of interracial relationships have yet to really receive mainstream support in some of those southern states.
And I think
there's a subliminal message that is given. If that were the case, then why not have a black woman in that ad that says, call me Harold? That was a decision made by campaign strategists to pitch to a certain segment of the electorate, I suspect white males, who are probably more likely to support the Republican candidate, because they could have easily chosen a black woman. So I think to suggest that race had nothing to do with the thinking behind that ad is a complete misread of not only current politics, but our history. So I don't think you can walk away from the racial factor. I would just suggest that given the fact that morality is not going to win the day for the Republican Party, not considering everything that they have on their plate, I think it was a dumb move by the Republicans, and I don't think it's going to work for them in Tennessee.
And I have to just very briefly respectfully respond to that. And my reading of history, it's I think your statement, candidly, is a little bit disingenuous. If there are those individuals in Tennessee who are not going to vote for an African-American man for the United States Senate based on a woman in a television spot, I think that's silly. I will make the distinction. I'm suggesting, however, that if individuals are racist and not going to vote for an African-American man for the United States Senate, I suspect that their minds have already been made up to this point and not based on one single ad with one blonde woman.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, December 16th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our second book study session on Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. The book was published in 2009. Again, the book was published right in between when President Obama won the 2008 election and when he was inaugurated in January of 2009. So that's the period when the book was published. The segment that you heard at the beginning of the program, that is from NPR's Roundtable from 2006, October 2006. It was hosted by Faraya Chidea. She's a black female journalist still doing lots of great work. And the panelists that you heard, female, two males. So the panelists were Walter Fields, Yvonne Bineau, and Ron Christie. Those were the other three individuals who commented about the segment. You heard about one of the individuals who is mentioned in the book, part of the breakthrough, these new politicians and how we are rethinking racism, white supremacy in the 21st century, is Harold Ford Jr. And you heard their discussion. He did lose that race. That's another thing to keep in mind. He did lose that race in Tennessee in 2006. So those commercials maybe were more effective than people thought, maybe. But that is that moment is something that was widely discussed in terms of racism. And you will still see, like in different some of the literature that I have read over the years, that specific commercial will be pointed out. When people talk about how racism in politics and some of the different forms that it takes, they'll mention Willie Horton, they'll mention that moment, and a few others. But that's something to kind of keep in mind. We'll go ahead and get started. I guess that's one of the things. I was critical of the text last week, but I do think it's important. There's a lot of information. I think last week, 1842, she said she didn't know about Colin Powell being thought about for president. There is a lot of other information in the book where I think we can learn and improve our understanding of racism, white supremacy by knowing more details about things. That's something that I am looking forward to doing in this book. But again, I do think even with the late Gwen Ifill and her unfortunate passing this year, I do think that we should critically analyze this book. And I think she would want us to do that as well with maximum black self-respect as we do so. We'll get started. We're picking up in Chapter 2, The Generational Divide. We're about midway in Chapter 2. This is Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1.
Here's one rough measure of how quickly the generational game changed. South Carolina State Representative Bakari T. Sellers was 21 years old when he defeated a 26-year incumbent. The first thing he hung on his Columbia office wall was a photo of himself at the age of 4 in the arms of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. By 23, he was an outspoken supporter of Barack Obama. Young Bakari, the son of another noted civil rights leader, Cleveland Sellers Jr., embodied the notion that waiting was a dated concept that has less and less to do with race. "The struggle has changed," Bakari Sellers told me. "If you're poor and black in South Carolina or poor and white in South Carolina, you face basically the same issues." This idea is emblematic of the thinking of the new generation of young black leaders. Midway through the election year, the NAACP, the nation's oldest civil rights organization, elected a 35-year-old president, Benjamin Jealous, nearly splitting itself in two in the process in 8 hours of contentious closed-door debate. Jealous, the president of a San Francisco Bay Area foundation, is the organization's 17th leader and its youngest ever. But he'd spent a decade cutting his teeth, working for organizations such as the National Newspaper Publishers Association and Amnesty International. At the age of 14, he began registering people to vote. Unlike previous NAACP heads, Jealous was neither an ordained minister nor an elected official, so his selection represented a drastic break. The NAACP, about to celebrate its 100th anniversary, has nevertheless spent the last 2 decades struggling with internal debate over money, mission, and leadership, just the sort of conflict that can result in wholesale change or wholesale collapse. "Ultimately, politics is war without bloodshed," Jealous told me. "Just like in war, you have to fight for the opportunity to lead." His rise at the NAACP seemed to come out of the blue, and not everyone was happy about it. Several members of the board complained of the tactics they said Jealous used to win the post. The dispute, which spilled into the newspapers, exposed yet another generational rift. Columnist George Curry wrote that Jealous got up before the board and dissed Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. Jealous says he did no such thing, but he freely admits that he subscribes to the notion that power must be seized, not passively inherited. "Look at the average age of people who led," he said, citing civil rights icons of years past. "I look at the fact that Malcolm and Martin were dead by 39 and Medgar was dead by 37, and they all had been involved in the struggle for over a decade at the leadership level by the time they died." Jealous was not alone in rethinking the mission of the nation's oldest civil rights organization. Eddie Glaw Jr., an influential 40-year-old professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University, is an outspoken critic of an old guard who he said was ruining the NAACP. He argues that older leaders were caught in a time warp and tended to fetishize dated forms of dissent. "We live in a post-civil rights age," he told me, "and we don't mean by that that civil rights is no longer important. That's where people get that kind of twisted." Glaude, who was born in 1968 at the height of the protest movements, published an article calling for rethinking the NAACP and says he received a harsh letter in reply from one of its elders, civil rights icon Julian Bond. Glaude remembers meeting Bond at Morehouse College when Glaude taught there. "I remember asking him," he said, "how did you guys do this? How did you get the older generation to pass the torch?" He said, "They didn't pass it, we took it." "And now that it's being taken from them," Glaude added, "they're crying foul." It should be noted, however, that 2 weeks after the 2008 presidential election, Bond announced he was relinquishing his chairmanship of the NAACP. Many of the surviving lions of the movement were among the most tardy to climb aboard the Obama bandwagon. Not so the Reverend Joseph Lowery, 82, co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who supported Obama early and enthusiastically. At the same time, he vigorously rejected the idea that the nation has moved past civil rights. We've been calling this almost ever since Martin died a post-civil rights era, Lowry said as we sat in his Atlanta office. And that's always given me problems because I don't think we're in a post-civil rights era. I think we're in a post-media top priority era. Electing a black president, he said, is an exciting, traumatic, dramatic turning point in the struggle. But it won't be the end. We'll still have many, many problems. Much of this debate boiled down to a conflict that Obama's success could never quite quell. On one hand, there was immense pride over the prospect of the election of a black president. I wouldn't be where I am if I waited on the people who told me it couldn't be, talk show host Oprah Winfrey told 29,000 voters crowded into a South Carolina stadium. The moment is now. On the other hand, there was widespread, scarcely concealed worry that in order to succeed, anyone who became the first black president would have to strain to escape the confines of race. Obama's African-American critics, the Reverend Jesse Jackson said before the election, want him to win and know that the price may be some tension. But if it does not work, that same group will be quick to say, we knew it was high risk. Obama somehow managed to escape one rite of passage for black politicians, the need to explain or distance himself from well-known but divisive leaders such as Sharpton, Jackson, and Louis Farrakhan. That comparison is one that isn't appropriate, Obama told the New York Times, referring to the tendency to compare him to other, more controversial leaders, because neither Reverend Jackson nor Reverend Sharpton is running for president of the United States. They are serving an important role as activists and catalysts, but they're not trying to build a coalition to actually govern. It is a challenge no white candidate ever has to deal with. Former North Carolina Senator John Edwards was never asked why he wasn't Jesse Helms, and Arizona Senator John McCain was allowed to accept the backing of controversial white supporters time and again with comparatively little blowback. Not so for black candidates. The shadows, links, and political equations to leaders of previous generations never went away. A sneaky, funny, and largely overlooked animated sketch on a campaign year episode of Saturday Night Live captured the tension perfectly. In it, Obama met with Jackson in a broom closet for, quote, secret strategy sessions, dispatching him as an envoy to imaginary African countries. Sharpton, meanwhile, was fitted with a collar that jolted him with an electric shock whenever he got too close to an Obama event. Sharpton insists he was playing an insider's game all along, often dialing up the presidential candidate for quiet chats that neither he nor the campaign was interested in publicizing. Blacks understand we got to march and vote, he told me, in the black areas where he needs 90% of the vote, but 90% of 4 million votes rather than just 2, it will help, especially with Jesse saying he ain't really helping, Sharpton said, adding up the value of increased black turnout in his head and relating his conversation with Obama. The balance the whites don't understand is he needs maximum black turnout while he tries to work on the percentage of whites. If he had me and Jesse lukewarm at the same time, that hurts his turnout. Jackson's grumbling from the sidelines attracted considerably more attention, including the famous occasion when he mumbled into an open microphone that he would like to cut Obama's nuts off for talking down to black people. To top it all off, Jackson casually dropped the N-word, not to describe Obama, but in a colloquial manner that still did not help. He swiftly apologized and told me on the night Obama accepted the party's nomination that he was only trying to broaden the breakthrough candidate's message. It is my job as a kind of force of conscience to say, let's focus on the working poor, he said. All around the country, entrenched and emerging politicians have spent the better part of the last decade trying to master the hat trick Obama pulled off this year. Former Birmingham Mayor Richard Arrington Jr., now 74, reflected on the shift that was occurring before his eyes in 2002 when he watched Representative Earl Hilliard, a five-term incumbent, go down to defeat at the hands of Artur Davis, a man decades younger. The people who vote and support endorsements of political organizations are my generation and maybe a generation behind me, Arrington said. It may also be a commentary on how blacks feel or how secure blacks are in our society today. I grew up in a time and served in office for a time that We felt like we had to unite. It was in our interest to block vote. With some of our blacks, many are doing better. They don't feel any need to maintain that herd instinct. You get outside the herd, you don't need to worry about the wolf getting to them. Eddie Glaw Jr. has a different take on the differences in worldview that drive the conflict between older black leaders who lit the torch and the younger ones who now want to relieve them of it. My generation struggles to find its political voice because we've come of age in the shadow of racism, said Glaude, who was born in 1968. What's interesting is we know the languages of that moment don't quite capture our own, and we are groping. We look different, we sound different, and what's so striking about the way in which the old guard responds to us is that they don't know what to do with us. And what's so striking to me as well is we don't quite know what to do with ourselves either. The pushback, however, has been predictable and insistent. When the Reverend Calvin O. Butts III, the legendary pastor of the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, endorsed Clinton on the eve of the 2008 King holiday, he stressed the importance of experience over the excitement generated by Obama, the younger candidate. Experience is not synonymous with status quo, nor should it be vilified for the sake of campaign soundbites, he said, reading from a prepared statement in Harlem's winter cold while Clinton stood nearby. With experience comes the value of lessons learned. In our quest for change, it's time that we return to the fundamentals: experience, ability, respect, character. The SCLC's Lowry rejected every bit of that. As one of the few members of the so-called old guard who opted to support Obama over Clinton early on, he dismissed the dissension that sprang up among the civil rights leaders who once marched with King. Some of that generation, he says now, claimed the first wave of leadership and then dropped the ball. Watching the rise and fall of some of those who stumbled, Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., and Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit come to mind, some talented young black leaders have opted out of seeking elected office entirely. But that pendulum appears to be swinging, and political veterans believe elected officials who plan to retire in office should now be watching their backs. Either you're going to pull yourself through the political ladder or you're going to stay in place and somebody's going to run right over you, said Donna Brazile, the Democratic strategist who ran Al Gore's 2000 campaign. That is what the Obama effect will actually come down to. Our folks are not going to sit down and wait for somebody to come and recruit them. They're going to recruit themselves to run for office. Ron Rice Jr., a 40-year-old city councilman in Newark, New Jersey, who is considering a run for Congress, is one of the self-recruiters. The folks who would consider themselves the classic black consensus would like to spin it that we are all stalking horses, Trojan horses, he told me. But it's that we understand we're going to be judged not by being the first or not being the first people of color who occupied seats. We're going to be judged, and rightly so, by the results that we bring to the table. I think that's fair. If we're going to tout new ideas and ways of looking at things and new paradigms of governance, I think we should be held responsible for results. But Obama's success in the end might undercut the very idea that diverse representation can be achieved only through the crafting of majority-minority districts, political affirmative action. A pair of husband and wife academics, Abigail and Stephen Thernstrom, she with the Conservative Manhattan Institute, he a history professor at Harvard, both among the nation's most vigorous opponents of affirmative action and racial preference, argued in a Los Angeles Times opinion piece well before the general election that the white support Obama received proved that racial preferences are no longer needed. Today, it is even clearer that race has become less of a factor in voting, they wrote. The high level of white votes for Obama strongly suggests that other black candidates facing overwhelmingly white constituencies can do well. Whites refusing to vote for black candidates has finally gone the way of segregated water fountains. Others quickly embraced that argument, including Ward Connerly, the black champion of race-blind government, campaigning in Denver on behalf of a state initiative that would have outlawed granting special hiring preferences to women or minorities. He declared Obama a post-racial candidate. "I applaud as an American his effort to keep race out of the equation," Connerly said. instantly confirming the worst political fears of many liberal black leaders. He is not a black candidate, he said. Connerly even wrote the Obama campaign a $500 check, but his Colorado initiative failed. Obama did not argue that he was not a black candidate, but the generational split did in some ways transcend race. Many of Obama's big endorsers, including Pennsylvania Senator Robert P. Casey Jr., were white politicians who said they were urged into the Obama camp by the entreaties of their children. Some of the generational tilt appeared to cross party lines as well. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell, a Republican, endorsed Obama just before the election. At least one of his daughters was a supporter of Obama, while his son, Michael Powell, a former Bush appointee, supported John McCain. Ron Dellums, who has come full circle from doorbuster in the 1960s through congressional insider in the 1970s and 80s to hands-on municipal leader now, says black leaders have got to stop treating change as a threat. You have to update your analysis, update the nature of your politics, he says. You can't be 1958, you can't be 1968. You have to be 2008, but you build on those realities. Dellums' conclusion, at least during the primaries, was that Hillary Clinton was better suited to build on those realities, but he was by far the exception to the rule in his age cohort. Roger Wilkins, who was an assistant attorney general under Lyndon B. Johnson, is a big Obama fan. I love this transition because my generation has done its work, says Wilkins, 76. Whatever one thinks of the result of that work, it was consequential work, and it did help change the nation. But now we're old, and there are people whose path we made possible who see the country very, very differently than we did. Seeing the world differently, he believes, is the key to breakthrough politics. Still, Andrew Young, who by Election Day was a full Obama convert, offers this caution to a generation of young leaders he sees pursuing future opportunities at the expense of lessons from the past. It's not sour grapes, he said of his hesitation. When you get to the promised land, and we're with you when you go all the way, don't forget how you got there. Don't forget that it was God who parted the Red Sea, who fed you in the wilderness when you were hungry. In other words, don't leave the past entirely behind. Chapter 3, Barack Obama. If you were to get a handbook on what's the path to the presidency, I don't think that the handbook would start by saying, be an African American named Barack Obama. Barack Obama. Two events in the course of Barack Obama's tumultuous 21-month campaign for president stand as testament to the clashing impulses of race and politics. One occurred on a bitterly cold morning in Atlanta, Georgia, the other on a perfect balmy evening in Denver, Colorado. A light snow dusted rooftops, and a thin sheen of ice coated the reflecting pool at the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site on Auburn Avenue the January day Obama arrived. This was unusual weather in the Deep South, and all across town, churches canceled Sunday morning services. But not at Ebenezer Baptist Church, not on the King holiday weekend. Obama, who almost exactly 1 year later would be sworn in as the nation's first African-American president, had an appointment that day in Dr. King's pulpit, or at least in the new version of it. The congregation at Ebenezer now worshipped in a soaring, modern sanctuary directly across the street from the old red brick church, which still stands. The future president laid a wreath on the graves of Martin and his wife Coretta, who are buried next door. Obama had come to Atlanta, a city where every other downtown street seems to be named after peaches or 1960s civil rights leaders, to pay his respects. Just the night before, Hillary Clinton had beaten him like a drum in the Nevada Democratic caucuses, and he was in need of reassurance. The warm and welcoming Sunday morning crowd was eager to supply it. 2,000 worshipers filled the sanctuary to the rafters. Hundreds more who could not get in braved the frigid weather outside to listen on loudspeakers. Here was the familiar, an African-American candidate for office entering a sanctuary, while a choir sang James Weldon Johnson's Lift Every Voice and Sing, known as the Negro National Anthem. Bill Clinton famously knew every word of every verse. Next, the candidate and the ministers clasped hands as the congregation swayed and joined in the full-throated singing of We Shall Overcome. The choir, surrounding the candidate on three sides and draped in kente cloth, broke into the rollicking gospel song, Victory is Mine. I told Satan, get thee behind. Victory today is mine. We don't take this pulpit lightly, the Reverend Raphael G. Warnock said as he introduced Obama. We invited this brother because he's committed, he's brilliant, he has a spiritual foundation, and he is the embodiment of the American dream. Regardless of whether you are a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, when you think about the long history of America, Barack Obama makes us proud. Congregants crammed into every seat on the floor and the balcony all but willed the young senator to bring them to their feet. But the candidate had other things in mind. This sermon would not be about race. Not exactly. Unity is the great need of the hour, he told the worshipers. It is the great need of this hour as well. Not because it sounds pleasant or because it makes us feel good, but because it's the only way we can overcome the essential deficit that exists in this country. Then Obama slipped into what would become a running theme when he addressed black audiences, spreading the blame around. All of us understand intimately the insidious role that race still sometimes plays on the job, in the schools, in our health care system, and in our criminal justice system, he said. And yet, if we are honest with ourselves, we must admit that none of our hands are entirely clean. If we're honest with ourselves, we'll acknowledge that our own community has not always been true to King's vision of a beloved community. This was classic Obama. When given the chance to talk about race in the ways most expected to hear, he resisted. Race was worth talking about, he thought, but only in the context of broader issues. You would never catch this black man with his fist in the air. Obama accepted the Democratic nomination for president at Invesco Field in Denver on the 45th anniversary of King's I Have a Dream speech. Once again, this time in front of 80,000 cheering supporters and 38 million television viewers, he was presented with a tailor-made opportunity to talk about the nation's racial history. Again, he sidestepped, although there was blackness all around him. Stevie Wonder, Jennifer Hudson, Will.i.am, and John Legend performed. Black politicians spoke. In the stands and on the field, black people danced, cried, and celebrated. But in the nearly 10-minute biographical video the campaign played on the stadium's gigantic screens, there was no acknowledgement that black history was about to turn a new page. Oscar-winning director Davis Guggenheim, who assembled the film, chose instead to emphasize Obama's Kansas roots, his white grandparents, and his white mother, alluding only briefly to his Kenyan father and his ties to the African nation where some of his relatives still live. Similarly, the film also raced past his multicultural upbringing in Hawaii and Indonesia. The nominee that night offered policy prescriptions and ritual attacks on the Republican nominee, but got to the final paragraphs of his speech before he alluded to the words of a young preacher from Georgia, never mentioning King by name. The men and women who gathered there could have heard many things, he said, referring to the March on Washington. They could have heard words of anger and discord. They could have been told to succumb to the fear and frustrations of so many dreams deferred. But what the people heard instead, people of every creed and color, from every walk of life, is that in America, our destiny is inextricably linked, that together our dreams can be won. This, too, was classic Obama. He did not deny his race, but he generally didn't bring it up either. You had to look in the pages of his acclaimed autobiography, Dreams from My Father, to learn about his admiration for Malcolm X and his collegiate flirtation with black activism. But the book also held these words. My identity might begin with the fact of my race, he wrote, but it didn't, couldn't end there. Obama and his advisors decided early on that he was not going to win the presidency by playing up his race. Those who would be drawn to that aspect of his biography would vote for him in any case, they reasoned. The toughest votes to win would come from those who might overlook or distrust him because of something he could not control, the color of his skin. The thing is, a black man can't be president of America, given the racial aversion in history that's still out there. Cornell Belcher, an Obama pollster who is himself African-American, told me after the election, "A black man can't be president of America. However, an extraordinary, gifted, and talented young man who happens to be black can be president." So Obama was to become the world's most famous black man, not by denying his biracial identity, but by embracing parts of it selectively. On the podium at the Democratic National Convention, we saw his Indonesian half-sister Mayo Satoru Ing, but not his Kenyan half-sister Oma Obama. And the omissions in his biography were not limited to race. There was just passing reference made to Michelle and Barack Obama's elite educations at Princeton and Harvard and to their law degrees. "He appreciates and embraces his blackness," observed Michael Eric Dyson, the Georgetown professor and author who climbed aboard the Obama presidential campaign bandwagon early. "But he doesn't want that to exhaust his agenda or determine what his vocational trajectory will be. What he will say, what he will do, how he will behave, how he will act." It was a fairly perilous tightrope Obama walked, and one that had never been managed at this level before. He had to integrate the tactical with the strategic, reaching out to some voters without alienating others, and change the face of black politics altogether. He did this in part by crafting his persona and his speeches to appeal to all listeners. On the night he won the Iowa caucuses, he was making history, but he allowed others to interpret his meaning when he bellowed, "They said this day would never come." "I knew that it would have multiple meanings to multiple people," Obama's 27-year-old white speechwriter Jon Favreau acknowledged later. Obama's caution continued even after he won the presidency. Steve Croft of 60 Minutes asked him after the election what he thought of his racial breakthrough, and Obama once again spoke of other people's reactions, the faces in the crowd, his mother-in-law, not his own. But it became clear early on that this would be no colorblind campaign. During the heated and competitive primary season, an edgy and alarming debate took place between Hillary Clinton and Obama about race, gender, and even the legacy of Bill Clinton. The former president had famously deemed Obama's plan for Iraq a fairy tale and compared Obama's South Carolina victory to Jesse Jackson's 20 years before. Then Hillary Clinton credited Lyndon B. Johnson rather than King, it seemed to critics, with getting the Civil Rights Act passed. "It took a president to get it done," she said. "That dream became a reality. The power of that dream became real in people's lives because we had a president who said, 'We're going to do it,' and actually got it done." Obama called her remarks ill-advised. Senator John Edwards told a black church audience he was troubled by the comment. "The Clintons were furious at being accused of playing the race card. There was not one shred of truth to suggestions that she was trying to exploit racial tension in the campaign," Hillary Clinton said indignantly on Meet the Press. "I don't think this campaign is about gender, and I certainly hope it is not about race." "She started this campaign saying that she wanted to make history," Obama replied tartly, "and lately she has been spending a lot of time rewriting it." But most of the time, Obama left it to his surrogates to defend him when it came to race. In narrowing the differences between Obama and the majority white nation he was appealing to, the campaign simply set out to erase race as a negative. This was no accident. The formula counted on white voters to be comforted by this approach and for black voters to be willing to look the other way. The story of this race is that race didn't play the decisive role people thought it would, David Axelrod, the campaign's chief strategist, told me shortly after the campaign ended. During the campaign, voters came to judge him as something other than just potentially the first African-American president. People very much came to judge him on his merits. In some quarters, however, Obama came across as a scold for repeatedly calling on the black community to lift itself up rather than asking others to do it for them. "We need fathers to realize that responsibility doesn't just end at conception," he told a gathering at the Apostolic Church of God on Chicago's South Side. "That doesn't just make you a father. What makes you a man is not the ability to have a child. Any fool can have a child. It's the courage to raise a child that makes you a father. Obama would point out that he liked hip-hop music, but not its often misogynistic lyrics. He told MTV he thought it was a waste of time for jurisdictions to pass laws banning young men from wearing fashionably sagging pants, but he added, having said that, brothers should pull up their pants. You are walking by your mother, your grandmother, your underwear is showing. Come on. And in a widely noted address to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the nation's oldest civil rights organization, Obama admitted he was aware of the sensitivity his comments stirred. I know some say I've been too tough on folks talking about responsibility, he said to the 3,000 members gathered in Cincinnati. At the NAACP, I'm here to report I'm not going to stop talking about it. Later in that speech, he added, when we are taking care of our own stuff, then a lot of other folks are going to be interested in joining up and working with us and taking care of America's stuff. Many conservative black churchgoers applauded this approach, rising up to their feet in venue after venue to cheer him on. But some black leaders wondered if something wasn't missing. Why wasn't Obama speaking as a champion for black people instead of pointing out their shortcomings? Why wasn't he talking specifically about racial disparities when he discussed issues such as education, health care, and criminal justice? Or, as Jesse Jackson famously whispered into that open microphone, was Obama talking down to black people? Obama was not in this to prove he could lead or speak only to black people. The goal here was to romance the entire country. When I asked him in the summer of 2007 about whether the prospect of electing a black president was affecting how people viewed him, he recounted a conversation he'd had with Jackson. He said something that's very accurate, Obama told me. He said, Barack, we had to break the door down, which sometimes means you're not polite. You get bloodied up a little bit. You get some scars. You haven't had to go through that, and that's a good thing. That's part of what we went through. I don't expect you to have the same battle scars that I did. Obama made his most overt attempt to acknowledge the racial debt in March 2007, when every living member of civil rights royalty gathered in Selma, Alabama, to observe and reenact the 1965 Bloody Sunday March across the city's Edmund Pettus Bridge. Georgia Congressman John Lewis, who had had his head bashed in with a brick during the original protest 42 years before, spent part of that day attempting to get Obama and Hillary Clinton to link arms for photographers. It did not work, but Obama was there with another goal in mind anyway. He needed to silence the naysayers within his own community, many of whom had known the Clintons long before they had ever heard Obama's name. I'm here because somebody marched, he said from the pulpit of Brown Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church. I'm here because you all sacrificed for me. I stand on the shoulders of giants. I thank the Moses generation, but we've got to remember now that Joshua still had a job to do. The previous generation, the Moses generation, he said, pointed the way. They took us 90% of the way there. We still got that 10% in order to cross over to the other side. So the question, I guess, that I have today is, what's called of us in this Joshua generation? He continued. What do we do in order to fulfill that legacy, to fulfill the obligations and the debt that we owe to those who allowed us to be here today? In invoking the notion that the baton should now be handed to a new generation of Joshuas, Obama was speaking for a cohort of young, accomplished African Americans who were also battling doubters within their own communities. Weeks later, Michelle Obama expanded on that theme to me, remarking that nothing worth having was ever going to come easy. You know, she said, this is what we were taught by the Moses generation. Short-term sacrifice. Suck it up. Isn't that what we went to all these schools for? I tell myself all the time, we're supposed to be the ones that take the risk. What do we have to lose? And I don't mean it lightly, but in the end, who can take these risks? Who can do it? The risks were many. Obama received Secret Service protection earlier than any other candidate in history. In the days after he won the November election, law enforcement agencies reported that threats directed at the newly elected president spiked dramatically. Such serious safety concerns made some of the racial jibes aimed at Obama during the campaign seem juvenile, but they acted as reminders that not all of America was buying into the notion of racial transcendence. It's hard to pick a favorite outrage. There were the men who wore monkey shirts to Obama's rallies and elected officials who called him uppity. There was the Kentucky Republican, Representative Jeff Davis, who referred to Obama as that boy during a GOP dinner in Frankfurt. There was the GOP vendor in Texas who marketed buttons that read, "If Obama is president, will we still call it the White House?" And there was the $10 box of Obama waffles sold at a conservative political convention, complete with a picture of a black man with Popeyes and big lips smiling at a plate of waffles. There was the newsletter distributed by a California Republican club that featured an Obama caricature surrounded by ribs, watermelon, and fried chicken, all on a fake food stamp. I could go on. The taunts did not come only from white Republicans. During the heated primary campaign, Robert Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television and a prominent Clinton supporter, managed to allude to Obama's teenage drug use. "Obama was doing something in the neighborhood," he said, as if steering around a confidence. "I won't say what he was doing, but he said it in his book." He also suggested Obama was a sellout, comparing him to Sidney Poitier's character in the interracial romance drama Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. This earned a rebuke even from the conservative columnist George Will. "For the uninitiated," Will wrote, "that is how you call someone an Uncle Tom in an age that has not read Uncle Tom's Cabin." "We're letting other people pick our leaders," Johnson later complained to the Washington Post. "I think we looked like we were going to win, and I think that an element of overt race awareness kicked in," campaign manager David Plouffe told me in the spring, "which is really, should it be this easy for this guy? Is he getting a break because he's an African-American political superstar? Each time he's looked like he could secure this thing, there's been a backlash." Most of the time, Obama refused to be drawn into the racial dramas. Whenever he did, as when he suggested mildly that he did not look like the other presidents seen on U.S. dollar bills, he was accused, as John McCain's campaign manager once said, of playing the race card from the bottom of the deck. Axelrod and Plouffe had worked for black candidates before, notably Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, and they were convinced talking about race was not going to get their candidate elected. Axelrod said it was a function of math. "It was obvious," he said, "that if you were going to play in a larger venue and not just a majority black one, you needed a candidate who could appeal to non-black voters." This worked for Patrick when he was elected governor in 2006. "I don't care whether the next president is the first black president or the first woman president or the first whatever, to tell you the truth," the governor told a Boston Common crowd early in the Obama campaign. "I care that the next president has moral courage, a political backbone, the humility to admit what he doesn't know, and the wisdom to learn from others." This approach, however, was thrown spectacularly off track in spring 2008, when Obama's pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., almost derailed the Obama candidacy. The campaign had worried about Wright enough to yank him from the program at Obama's February 2007 announcement of his candidacy. But that was before snippets of videotape surfaced featuring Wright at his most incendiary. It was a controversy which we explore at greater length in Chapter 8, ultimately kept alive by the resentful and unhelpful Wright himself. The association with a church that characterized itself as unashamedly black and unapologetically Christian immediately undercut Obama's labored efforts to portray himself as race neutral. Even sympathetic Obama supporters asked how he could not have known about Wright. The future president had little choice but to attempt to calm the waters his old friend had roiled. Only then did he finally decide to talk about race. Obama, wearing an ice blue tie on St. Patrick's Day, strode into an interview with me in the midst of the Wright storm. He was subdued, clearly troubled, and laboring under the weight of too little sleep and too much controversy. I asked him if all this had been inevitable, this blow-up about race, politics, and grievance. It would have been naive for me to think, he said, that I could run and end up with quasi-front-runner status in a presidential election as potentially the first African-American president and that issues of race wouldn't come up any more than Senator Clinton would expect that gender issues might not come up. But ultimately, he mused, I don't think it's useful. I think we've got to talk about it. I think we've got to process it. But we've got to remind ourselves that what we have in common is far more important than what's different. His pastor's comments, Obama said, lapsing into the harshest language he would use all week, were stupid. We benefit from that past, he told me. We benefit from the difficult battles that were taking place, but I'm not sure that we benefit from continuing to perpetuate the anger and the bitterness that I think at this point serves to divide rather than bring us together. The next day, Obama channeled his thinking into a speech that decried the nation's racial stalemate and returned to his campaign's most uplifting themes, change and hope. The profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society, Obama said. It's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress has been made, as if this country, a country that has made it possible for one of his own members to run for the highest office in the land and build a coalition of white and black, Latino and Asian, rich and poor, young and old, is still irrevocably bound to a tragic past. Wright himself suggested that Obama was ducking a race debate. I do what pastors do, he said. He does what politicians do. I am not running for office. But by then, Obama was not much listening to Wright anymore.
Context of white supremacy. That is the end of the first audio segment. We should be all set for audio segment number two. Once we have our discussion, the number to dial if folks have commentary they would like to share is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, but you still want to join us for the discussion, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. The address again, tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Once you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link for the VOPE line. Click that link. When you do so, it will open a small window on your screen. On the top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943. You'll see the code, the space for the code. It's on the next line, 564-943. Final line, it'll ask for a name. You can put real name in. You can click random keys. You can use a nickname, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button bottom of the little link window there. Once you do that, you should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6
When you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt. Press the number one. We will get you on the line. Folks have comments they would like to share. Feel free. My question, I'm just tossing this out. If you would like to respond as you give your thoughts, observations, fine. If you want to save it till later, that's fine as well. Earlier in the section we read this week, she said that President Obama, he would kind of pick and choose his spots when he would, quote unquote, appreciate his blackness, right? So whatever that means. Have any of you all seen times where you would say, oh, yeah, this is a moment where President Obama is, quote unquote, appreciating his blackness, whatever that means? Do you have a Obama appreciating blackness moment? And if you could share, that would be grand. All the folks who dialed in with the hand up should be with us. We were a little late get starting today. Man, massive turmoil, but we kept right on chugging. No quit, no discouragement. Thanks, folks, for being patient. Everybody who dialed in who has a hand up should be with us. Feel free.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Actually, let me make this so it's okay. This might be better. I enjoyed the second part better than the first. I learned quite a bit. I will say this first because it has nothing to do with anything else, any of the other notes. But she has a pretty singing voice, and I actually appreciated her that little bit that she did in her book. I think that that's really awesome. And she, I can tell, like, sometimes I'm not appreciative of the tone that she takes when she, like, I guess I'd appreciate it more if she was going to voice white people the way that she voices black people, like, if she made that distinction. But she seems to only, quote-unquote, voice black people, like, stereotypical tones and things like that, which I'm not really sure how I feel about quite yet. Maybe if she did it to white people, like took a quote-unquote white tone or something like that, I might feel better, but I'm not sure yet. She did, right before you cut it off, she did start talking about right, which I was happy that she does do that, because at the beginning part of the reading, she said that Obama didn't distance himself from other black quote-unquote leaders, and I was like, that's a lie, but she brought it in, so it's fine. One thing that stood out to me, because I really did not know about Colin Powell, and that was like something, a light bulb went off, because I did not know that, I wasn't able to link Obama's presidency in with anything else before. I know Jesse Jackson, but for me that didn't count. That was like him wanting to do it. This was whites wanting Colin Powell to do it, and I felt like whites wanted Obama to be in office. So, and when Colin Powell said no, I think that they either had already had a plan B, which seems very like white strategic thinking to me, or were ready to implement the grooming of another black person. And then when I think about what they look like, you know, I could, it's, they're so similar, Colin Powell and Obama. So, but I think that it was necessary, and this might evolve or change, it's just a thought right now, that whites wanted a black face, quote-unquote, in office for a couple of reasons, possibly to embolden whites. Maybe white people were feeling like other white people were getting slack, like powerful whites are feeling like less powerful whites were getting slack with their terrorism or being white, or they just needed to inject some more fuel into the system to keep it going. They needed a black face to take the fall for all the things, like they needed a scapegoat. They needed that someone to clean up their mess. Even if it really didn't get clean, they just needed someone to blame it on so that whites could be clean again. And it wasn't like white people just messed everything up. And who knows, like we might not even see how bad it'll be until like now. But then even then, like if it, when it gets bad in our near future, they'll still blame it on President Obama, even though it's Trump. Like he'll be taking the fall for things like 20 years down the line. That's just a speculation. And then to further confuse black people, which I think is always an aim with white people. So I think that's why. But I'll keep paying attention to that because I didn't know that. So that was really important. And a metaphor, Clinton beat Obama like a drum. I just have a question mark and an exclamation point. Like, really? And then I did not know. I think you all have read his biography or autobiography. I have not, so you all might have already known this. I did not. I did not know he had an Indonesian half-sister. And I didn't know that he had an African-Kenyan, I suppose. I'm not 100% sure. I could be ignorant right now, but I'll just say African half-sister named Ama, who he didn't acknowledge. So it's definitely fleshing out President Obama in my eyes, this reading. I also just have another exclamation point that he had 27-year-old white people writing his speeches. Not all of them, but, you know, ghostwriting his speeches. I was just like, And then this point I'll say, and this will be my last one, she posed the question, was Obama talking down to black people? And I do remember this when I was slightly keeping up with the news. But then she said that he wanted to romanticize all people. And then I was like, you know, okay, you have this white mom, which sometimes I actually forget that he has a white mom. I think, like, Michelle helps me forget that, too, because she's so brown and so beautiful. Like, I just completely forget sometimes that President Obama has a white parent. But anyway, and now I know he has an Indonesian half-sister. But anyway, to romanticize all people. And then in my mind, I was like, you know what? The fastest, most effective way to get all other non-white but also non-black people to kind of like you is to disrespect or be hard on, criticize, judge black people. And just real quickly, I'm 1842. Sorry, I didn't say that at the beginning. I'm 1842, property management, not workplace, but just to tell you, we have Hispanic engineers. We were outside. There's a lot of homeless people, a majority of them being black. He proceeded to say, I don't understand. I've only been here for like 9 years, and, you know, whatever. I was like, whoa, pause right there. You know, completely out of context. You ain't been here for the last 400, 500 years. You don't get to comment on how we're responding to it. But that not only does it make white people feel good that we are in the position that we're in, but I'm beginning to realize and I maintain that it makes other non-white people feel good, non-white, non-black people feel good to also degrade, belittle, disrespect, and look down on black people. And I think that's what President Obama did. I'm postulating that is what Ms. Eiffel is saying when she says that he romanticized all people, because they, if they're following the news, might hear him speaking to black people and say, you know what, that's right. That black man is telling them other black people, get your stuff together. Stop asking us for stuff. Look, we got here a couple years ago. We're good, Asians, Hispanics, we, you know, have suffered and all that kind of stuff. And we come here, we have culture, even other African people, you know what I'm saying? So what's up with you? Even President Obama is telling you to get your stuff together. So what? It's your fault. And with that, I'll chime in later if we have time, and I'll think about your question, guys. Thanks.
Right on. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary. Good to hear from 1842. Other folks have commentary.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. Caller from the 712 here, chiming in. And just listening. I was doing something else, but I was listening. And what stuck out to me, a lot of things stuck out to me, but I think the most thing that stuck out to me was when Gwen Eiffel said that black people have control of the church system, and it's the only thing that we've ever really had full control over. And I don't believe that at all. From the time we were put in church, I'll say we were put in church, it was never any control, and right up until now in 2016. Also, I want to say, kind of going off of what the previous caller said, and I agree with a lot of the things that she said, when they were going through Barack Obama's lineage, I think it was maybe it was the video that someone put together, and they, you know, his white mom and maybe his grandparents and everything, and they didn't really say anything about the black side of his family, if I remember correctly. And that is true. You look at Barack Obama, and you wouldn't I mean, if you didn't, you weren't really on top of it, you weren't really going. He's got, you know, Ms. Michelle Obama, a black woman, he got two black children, you wouldn't really know that he had a white parent looking at him as being a black man. And so I want to ask everybody, do you think Barack Obama, how do you think his presidency, or if he even would have been elected president, if he would have been married to a white woman? And that's the question that I have for everyone, and that's my observation so far for the reading, from the readings. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to the callers and the listeners. To answer the previous caller's question, I don't think he would have ever made it in office had he been married to a white female, because there's no way, in my opinion, that white people would ever have a show a black man in a position where he has a white female and that person is the president. It's almost like he would have too much. In other words, like they just wouldn't allow for what that visually would look like. In my opinion, I don't think that that's something that they would tolerate on any level. So definitely, in my opinion, I don't think he would have made it to the presidency whatsoever. And I think he might have lost a lot earlier during the primaries had that been the case, in my opinion. I also think him being married to Michelle Obama, specifically based on what the previous two females callers said, to me is part of the reason why, in my opinion, he was like the worst thing that happened to us since the civil rights era, because he's just has been put in such a showcase position where there's a lot of things that the average black person was not thinking about due to the cosmetics of what he and his wife and his family look like versus the reality of him having a white parent, which I think Gus has shown time and time again how important it is in regards to understanding what having a white parent can do to the psyche of the black child, and especially in a situation where that child is raised by the white parent. And Barack Obama was just, to me, just the biggest form of propaganda warfare put on black people since the civil rights era. And that was part of the issue. I think the caller previous to the last caller made an accurate observation in regards to the fact that he was playing off of during his run to the elections, I mean to the presidency, that he was playing off of the fact that to abuse black people is appealing to both non-white, non-black people as well as white people. And I think part of it was on, I don't even know what page this is because I have the Kindle version, but it says here, oh yeah, so Obama was to become the world's most famous black man, not by denying his biracial identity, but embracing parts of it selectively. On the podium at the Democratic National Convention, we saw his Indonesian half-sister, Maya Satoru Ng, but not his Kenyan half-sister, Alma Obama. And I think that that is just very telling. It seems to me like he was groomed by white supremacists, and it seems like he might have been groomed by them through a hefty portion of his life, especially leading up to his run for the presidency, because for him to understand that deeply, that it would not have been good for him to show his African sister, but yet he's parading around with his half-Indonesian sister, speaks volumes to what he either was told to do, which I think that was part of it, or he might have innately known based on his understanding of white supremacy and the fact that he was raised by his white relatives. And it's something that I think is true because Dr. Wilson was extremely accurate when she talked about, she kept repeatedly bringing up, you know, if you're black, get back, if you're brown, stick around, if you're mellow, if you're yellow, you're mellow, and if you're white, you're all right. And the whole idea is that some non-white people think about black people the same way we've read about and heard about white people start thinking. Like, you always see, like, dirt poor white people, and they'll say, well, at least I'm not a nigger. So I think even in the minds of some non-white people, in their minds, at least I'm not black. You know what I mean? I'm not as dark as you all. And for some reason, they might, depending on where they're from, they might have a quote-unquote exoticness to their appearance. That in their minds is weight, trust, anything about being black. So in their minds, it's a lot easier to make progress in society by enjoying the same abuse of black people that white people do. There was another quote that I highlighted as well. Let me see if I can find it real quick, and then I'll mute my line. Where is it? Come on. Okay, here it is. Oh, yeah, it says, his pastor's comments, Obama said, lapsing into the harshest language he would use all week, were stupid. We benefit from that past, he told me. We benefit from the difficult battles that were taking place. But I'm not sure that we benefit from continuing to perpetuate the anger and bitterness that I think at this point serves to divide rather than bring us together. These are the kind of quotes that make me think he was groomed by white supremacists for this position, because of the fact that he's basically playing the same role as a black male that white people have in regards to trying to make black people forget what we've gone through and just move past something that has not been addressed in over 500 years. We've never made any strides towards healing collectively as a people. There's no mental health services for black people. We have no access to anything of substance to help us really process what we have been through, acknowledge what we've been through, accept what we've been through, and then actually consciously, not haphazardly, but consciously work to heal through what we've been through. And this kind of rhetoric in his discussion is stuff that we've heard white people say. To be honest, with the kind of stuff we've been through, we should be a lot angrier than we actually are, at least as more than we display publicly. And for him to make these kind of statements throughout the book really brings home to me and makes me understand deeply why he was just a bad thing for black people psychologically. It was great cosmetically, but outside of the cosmetics of having a black family in the Oval Office and in the White House, ultimately it was the greatest disservice because he really did nothing to help us overall as a people deal with white supremacy. Thank you. Now I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that. Other folks we have not heard from? Did you all have commentary? Other people we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I'm going to try to not try to use or misuse stuff that I was reading. I was listening to. I know last week I misunderstood a metaphor. So if I do, just chalk it up to VGQ. So she mentioned an Andrew Young quote, and I'm just going to paraphrase where he said when they were talking about black politicians, you know, making the breakthrough, and he said he asked the question of, remember who got you there. And he referenced God. And here's probably one of the things that I feel why, you know, black people are very ignorant of politics, because, you know, one of the things that with black people when they get black politicians in, and this is true of Obama, is that they never hold him accountable. So accountability within the realm of politics with black people seems to be non-existent. So probably
pause for one second. That's one of those. I generally just hush and people say whatever they want, you know, however I feel about it. That hold black people accountable, it's nails on a chalkboard for a metaphor. It is woo. And the reason I have such a problem with it is I have no idea what that means. I have no idea what black people could have done over the last 8 years. We're going to go stand out in front of the White House, and then, damn it, Obama, you are going to do right by us. You are going to go down to Ferguson, and you are going to prosecute Darren Wilson, and you are going to go up to Flint, and you are going to do this, and boom, 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 and just go down to the... How would black people do that? You already heard in the book this week, they had to start protection on him immediately. Dr. Welsing emphasized that all the time. This is what white people can do. We can threaten your whole family. And we have a myriad of ways to do it. That we, racist man and racist woman, we have more ways of holding Negroes accountable than any of you can dream of. That's what I'm saying. And I've never heard anyone explain it to me where it makes sense. It sounds great. I've heard that in like speeches for like 50 years. I'm not 50, but I've seen video where people have said that for years, and people will stand up, that's right, we got to hold them up. What does that mean? And how come we haven't figured out how to hold black people accountable since people have been sent? Because it's not like that's a new idea. How come we have not figured out how to hold black, whatever that means, how come we haven't figured out how to do that?
Okay. Can I just explain? Maybe it might not come across correctly, but here's what I see holding accountable. Maybe I might be using the wrong terminology here, but when Obama does something, And basically, when Obama does something that is logically, let's just say logically wrong, and black people, especially those who are loyal to Obama, would make an excuse, well, he's not the president of black America, he's the president of the United States. That's what I mean when I say holding him accountable. Maybe, like I said, maybe I'm using the wrong verbiage, but the thing is that most black people who support Obama would make an excuse on why Obama did something that wasn't in the best interest of black people. So that's what I mean about black people holding black politicians accountable.
Okay.
If, like I said, if I'm wrong, you know, just chalk it up to BGQ.
I could be wrong as well, and I certainly am not trying to talk down to another victim. It's just that one in particular, because I, and anyone who's listened to the Cows for a period of time, they have heard me say something about this before. I've heard Mr. Fuller talk about this before. He has a great sound clip. I've heard it for years, and even that alone, where I've heard this for so long, why is this still a problem? Where you've had so many black people saying for decades, we need to hold these up, and it's never white people. That's another thing that's strange, too, in a system of white supremacy. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, now we are going to hold these crackers account. I've never heard that. It's only other victims of white supremacy, which is just mind-boggling to me. I have no idea how one slave holds another slave accountable. We're both in the cotton field, and I'm going to hold Nigger Jim accountable today. Yep, I'm getting lashed, too. And I got my sack of cotton, but I am going to hold Nigger Jim. Okay, I don't know any context of white supremacy. We're in a prison. I'm in a cell, and I'm going to hold the person in cell B next to me. I'm going to hold him accountable if he is not responding in a way that I think is correct. It just, I could be totally wrong. Gus could be talking crazy. I didn't get enough sleep today either, so I could really be out of my mind. But that is one, just to be authentic to Gus T, I do have to say something, because it almost, I almost want to retch when I hear anybody. It could be my mom saying, we got to hold him accountable. And I would say the same thing, like, oh my God, my mom is killing me right now. I will hush, sir, whatever other commentary you have. And please forgive me if I was rude or disparaging or was not treating you as though Gus T Renegade is not a slave too, because I am still learning.
Oh, no. And it's not, it wasn't rude, but that's a whole different subject. We'll talk about that later. To continue on, the Obama speech in Denver, which you mentioned, and, you know, I'm going to admit I did vote for Obama in 2008. But one of the things, when he did that speech in Denver, I should have listened to my first intuition, because when I was listening to the speech and I reread it again, it did bring up some warning signs there, where, you know, he never mentioned Dr. King, but he kept mentioning the young pastor from Atlanta, or whatever, you know, terminology he used for Dr. King. And as far as language, he uses race instead of racism. So, you know, that kind of like, you know, brought a lot of things out that I should have listened to. You know, I should have went with my first instinct about Obama back then when I listened to that speech in Denver. There was another person who was using language where I can't remember who the person was, but they used post-civil rights era, and it sounds so similar to post-racial era. So I'm not sure if that's the same thing, but it sounds similar, but, you know, basically the myth of, you know, whether it be post-racial or post-civil rights eras, you know, coming up again. You just mentioned the death threats for Obama. I was working in downtown Chicago at the time, and I specifically remember the office Obama was in, Homeland Security had a huge presence there, and I basically had to walk around three blocks because I had to walk by the building that Obama's office was in, and I remember I had to walk like three blocks or so to get to work. So I definitely remember that. And then Ron brought up the when Obama talked about Wright's comments was stupid, and he talked about Obama talked about that we benefited from that pass, and I'm like, what benefit do we have from being lynched, from being having dogs sit on us and water hoses? I'm not getting what that benefit was from the pass, so. That was, I guess that was it for now, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. Appreciate being patient. Thank you for being patient with Gus as well, sir. Let's see. Anybody that we have not heard from? Anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from? Oh, we got everybody? Is that it? Nobody, we didn't miss anybody? I thought it was one person, but I will assume we got everybody. Grant, if other folks who dialed in, if you have comments you want to get in, just get your hand up. We have roughly 10 minutes or so before we get to the next, 15 minutes or so before we get to the next audio segment. Quick things. Wanted to point out, we did read Dreams from My Father. That was one of the first books that we did in our book club way back. Matter of fact, we had pretty awesome timing with that one as well. We read Dreams from My Father right in the middle of the 2012 presidential election. I think it was right at the end of October, and right, I think, a week or so before he won the re-election. So you can go back. It'll be interesting spirit of the times for what was going down for the 2012 presidential election. Very, very, I think, informative read. I would definitely recommend it. You get some interesting tidbits about his white mother, his childhood, some interesting episodes of racism with his white grandparents in Hawaii, and some of the whites that he went to school with. I think I said repeatedly, I think when we read that book in 2012, that was the second time I had read it, and it just reaffirmed what I thought the first time I read it, that President Obama is not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. Before, when he wrote that book, he was not ignorant, and I'm sure after 8 years in the White House, that's like postgraduate school for the system of white supremacy. So I'm sure he is very informed after all the shenanigans that he has seen over the last 8 years. Things that I highlighted in the book, the metaphors really stood out for me again. I think I was kind of critical of the book last week, just more so lots of metaphors. It doesn't seem accurate about racism, white supremacy, and it does not seem to have aged well. She was talking last week about Bill Cosby being accepted in white people's homes. That it has not aged well. So some of the things that I picked out, she spends a lot of time, like in this book, which is kind of a pattern for us, the squabbles that were happening amongst black people. I guess that might be interesting at some level, but I mean, on the dawn of the Trump era, I'm not sure how valuable it is. I'm not saying people shouldn't talk about it. I'm just saying on the scale of things that are important priorities, squabbles around Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and where black people were in terms of when they began to support President Obama, I don't know how important that is going to be 50 years down the road. We'll have to think about it. That's something you all can think about. Maybe I'm just missing something, but that just seemed like for this to have taken up the first like third of the book, so much of this to be focused on like squabbles amongst black people. And I said last week when she said that black people represented some of President Obama's biggest challenges, and I said that's absurd. It's highly inaccurate in a system of white supremacy, given everything that was happening then and everything that has happened subsequently, to spend so much time focused on, you know, Jesse Jackson wasn't down with him, or you had a certain sector of black people that were supporting Hillary Clinton and Spike Lee thought they were, you know, sellouts and uncle. I mean, I'm not sure the value moving forward. The commentary about that Saturday Night Live sketch, I feel like there is a lot, like Gwen Ifill, she is very polished, very skilled at her craft in journalism in terms of reporting. She demonstrated that for a long period of time. She is very informed about this subject. Seems like she pays a lot of attention to politics and is able to incorporate a lot of other different kind of tangents along with what was happening with Obama's presidential run. But when she talks about that Saturday Night Live sketch, and I mentioned it last week, and I posted it last week because she the audio segment I played at the beginning of the program, she talked about that Saturday Night Live cartoon where he takes at the time it would have been Senator Obama, he takes Jesse Jackson, they go into like a broom closet, and he makes up a country, almost like Zamunda, out of like Coming to America. It's like, yeah, you're going to be the ambassador to Zamunda, just somewhere to get this nigga out of here, send him someplace. And then Al Sharpton, he acts like he's putting a medal on him, but it's a dog collar, and he just shocks him every time he comes to the event. And she said here, she listed this skit as sneaky, funny, and largely overlooked. I don't think it's sneaky. I don't think it's funny. I think it's flagrant racism. It's the same type of thing, and particularly aimed at Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. Like, find some new niggas to ridicule. I'm talking about Gwen Ife. I'm talking about the people at Saturday Night Live that did this tacky skit. And I think both with it might even apply across the board, Gwen Ife, President Obama, any other non-white people that you would like to name, maybe that is a part of your quote-unquote breakthrough. Maybe that's a part of your success. You have to do and or say lots of things to appease racists, whether that's talking down to black people about pull up your pants, be a dad, stop having all these children and not taking care of them, or praising a racist Saturday Night Live skit. Again, I could be talking crazy. Let's see. The next thing... do you all know who Ward Connolly is? We can keep silent. So if you do know who Ward Connolly is, you can just say yes. If you do not, then we can just keep silence. Anybody know who Ward Connolly is?
I've heard of him, but I'm not super familiar with him, but I definitely have heard of him.
Okay. I would assume people do not know. You can Google his name if you are so inclined, Ward Connolly. He was mentioned when they were talking about the attack against affirmative action. That was for Ward Connolly. I thought that was fascinating that she included him in there. And in fact, just some of the terms that I was noting as well as I was going through the text, the Ward Connolly was mentioned in Denver when he went out there to work against affirmative action, when they were saying, President Obama represents the end of this. We don't need affirmative action for black politicians. They can win. White people will support them. Again, like some of this, I feel like I don't even need to respond to the absurdity. It is self-evident how incorrect that is, particularly on the dawn of, I feel like that's all I need to say. Count the days down to the Trump era. Just like, wow, I don't even, moving forward. The metaphors were huge in this section. There were a lot of biblical metaphors, and I think anything that encourages and reinforces victims of racism, particularly black people, to think about racism in an emotional manner should be rejected. I would really have a lot of caution around invoking a lot of religious metaphors. I know that's powerful for some people, and I'm not saying that spiritual needs to be forgotten or ignored. I'm just saying that I think a lot of times invoking a lot of spiritual or religious references, it can cause confusion. It can generate a lot of arguments. And I think sometimes it moves us away from being logical in the way that we assess this problem. And that's what we mean more than anything. The Creator gave us a brain, and I think for a reason we can think and solve some of these problems. Let's see, a couple other things, and then I'll hush. And if people have anything they want to get in before we get to the second audio segment, let's see. When she said even something as subtle as this, she, in my opinion, I felt it this week, I felt it last week, there seems to be an air of contempt directed towards Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton at times. I could be misreading, but I felt it much more last week, just in what was presented and thinking that Saturday Night Live skit was sneaky and funny and that sort of thing. The portion where she says she's talking about President Obama and him making this effort to not play up the fact that he's black so he can appeal to white people. She says Obama and his advisors decided early that he was not going to win the presidency by playing up, they say, his race. It's really playing up that he's not white. Those who would be drawn to that aspect of his biography would vote for him in any case. They reasoned the toughest votes to win would come from those who might overlook or distrust him because of something he could not control, the color of his skin. Why can't we just say white people? This is one of those where I'm just like, we've had no problem talking about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. They're gadflies and nobody wants them around. They're controversial and blah, 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 and praising this. Why can't we just say white people if we're going to keep it real? That's something that I notice as well. I'll get in two more things and then I will hush. I thought it was interesting as well that it seemed like they were switching back and forth between referencing President Obama as a black man and biracial. And I think that in and of itself answers the female's question about could he have been president. if he did not have a white mother. I think you can also point at retiring, outgoing Senator Harry Reid, his comments that he got in trouble for. I think that was back in 2009, where he said President Obama would not have won the presidency if he had been darker. Some of his paleness is due to the fact that he has a white mother, irrefutable. So I think absolutely he could not, he would not have been in this position. Last comment, let's see, last comment I'll get in. They had a lot of reenactment. I heard that word. It seemed like theatrics, a lot of this, the video presentation in Denver, the reenactment of Selma, and he's done that a lot now. They did the 50-year one, and I think they said Congressman John Lewis was trying to get Hillary Clinton, President Obama to hold hands when they were doing the 45-year anniversary of the march on the Selma Bridge, and particularly with Selma, I mean, John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, he gets a VGQ as well, for sure. I would never have anything to say against him, but if I was John Lewis or any of the other black people who were brutalized on that bridge in Alabama in 1965, there is no way this is going to be like a reenact. Like, this is theater. This is drama. We can all come out and get dressed up. And okay, so I'm going to get down. This is where you hit me with the club at. Okay, can I get some fake blood? And, I mean, what? That, I mean, just that is the insanity of white supremacy. We go out and reenact battles. Not that we don't have any going on right now. We have them all the time, but we love, this is what we get trained to love and thirst for blood. And particularly if we get to brutalize some niggers, we're going to have reenactments. Let's go out and reenact the Civil War. Let's go out and reenact when we beat them niggers on the bridge that day. It is insanity. Unless, you know, I'm just totally talking crazy. I will stop there. Folks have any other commentary they want to get in? Take about 6-7 minutes or so, and then we'll get to audio segment number two. Any other comments folks wanted to share?
I wanted to ask what the question was that you had asked, because I didn't get to hear it. Excuse me.
During the section we read this week, there was a portion where she said, she was talking about how President Obama, he could, like, selectively enforce when he wanted to, like, play up, appreciate his blackness. And I said, whatever that means, do any of you all have moments over the last 8 years that you recall or that you would point out and say, yes, in my opinion, President Obama was appreciating his blackness at this moment?
Mm.
Whatever that means.
Wow. Well, whatever that means, I would say no. I think, in my opinion, even though he did talk about race at times, he never talked about it explicitly. And in my opinion, he tended to try and veer away from that as much as possible. And throughout his presidency, in my opinion, stay race neutral quite a bit, whatever that means. But I would say just try to stay in a specific lane in which he tried not to step on the toes of white people. And he continued to just try to, I think he really didn't want to be associated with black people that much outside of maybe dancing, because he went to a few shows, and even towards the end of his presidency, they had a whole BET celebration with all of these artists and Usher and all these people dancing around him. Outside of that stuff, like the stuff that's typically associated with black people, food and partying and nonsense like that, there was no real association with black folks, so I definitely would say no to that question. And my answer would be no. He, in my opinion, never showed any sort of what was the term?
Appreciation. Appreciating his blackness.
Yeah, and how do you appreciate what you're born to be? Like, how do you appreciate that? Like, you're right. Whatever that means, I would say no. Thank you. Wow. Ooh.
Anybody else, any moments where they think President Obama was appreciating his blackness? Or if you had anything else you wanted to get in, that's fine too. But, you know, anything else?
I'm sorry, I'm going in. This is a caller from the 712. I don't think that he had a moment when he, and I'm like, Roz, or what was appreciating blackness. I don't really know what that would mean, but I can't remember any time. And I want to bring this up too. When Hillary Clinton said that, you know, it took a president to get that civil rights thing going. It took Lyndon B. Johnson. Now, you know, Hillary Clinton, she's not, I don't know, if she doesn't seem like she's a good person, but she was not lying. In that instance, Martin Luther King did have to go and basically ask, you know, a white person, a racist white supremacist suspect, can we do civil rights? And he did have to say either yes or no. So, I think that was correct that Lyndon B. Johnson had to push that through. And not, Martin Luther King just went and asked him. And that, yeah, that's what I had to say. Thank you.
Right on. She pulled that again this year during the election cycle, I think, when she had she spoke with some Black Lives Matter protesters, and it was basically the same thing. She kind of chided them and saying that, you know, it's not about hearts and minds. You need policy. It was the exact same thing. You know, Dr. King went out and did all that nonsense with, I'm paraphrasing, she didn't say nonsense, but, you know, he went out and did all that and blah, 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 and hearts and minds, but you still need policy. You need, she just didn't say a white person ought to be in office to grab that pen and put that bill in place to make some laws happen to actually make change possible. She did the exact same thing again this year. I also wanted to say, The Radiant, 1842. I thought that was an important point as well about the speechwriter for the campaigning Obama in 2008 being a 27-year-old white man. Just hold that up on this week when at the time of the Mother Emanuel AME shooting, Dylann Roof was 21. You can be a young white person and do mighty, mighty things in the system of white supremacy. Anything else? Are we good? Anything else folks want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is 1842. Really quick, when you said that, I forgot. I had also made a note that President Obama campaigned on the platform of change and hope. And it was funny because while I was listening to this reading, I think I postulate that a majority of non-white Black people heard change and thought systematic change, hope for Black people, you know. But what I'm starting to think now is Obama was, it was like more of a statement directed to Black people, like change, just based off some of the things that I heard in this segment's reading. And it's funny because that is like, that's one of the powerful things about language that I'm beginning to understand, that a lot of things are, and that might be even code, you know, you can say it and people are going to take it however they take it, but certain people will catch what you're saying because I don't know if I'm being clear, but you can say one thing and it can have multiple meanings and different people are going to read it differently and you're able to hide messages within certain things and also like manipulate a situation or deliver a message. And it could just, you know, maybe white people even heard change out of a Black man's mouth and then heard him tell Black people change. It was like, not, you know, not we change. He's telling them to change. And, you know, maybe we have hope, but that whole change and hope thing now is kind of up in the air for me. And I'm revisiting my interpretation of it because I was like the way that I said it the first time, he said change. I didn't think this is why I didn't follow the politics. Like I knew it wasn't going to happen, but that could have just been pessimistic, not because I had any clear understanding of racism, white supremacy. It was just, I was more pessimistic about everything. But you know, if I was into it, I was thinking systematic change, for us, change in on behalf of Black people and stuff, but no, not anymore. I think that was some kind of code and more of a statement directed towards us rather than for us. Thank you.
For sure. I thought that is standard racist tactic in terms of using language. That's why I say with definitions, that's what you end up with. When you use terms and they have no definition, everybody can guess. Everybody can guess and come up with their own interpretation. When you have vaguely phrased sentences, everybody can come up with their own interpretation. And we can say everyone's. That's where you end up with that nonsense. Another one that's on Gus's hate list, your truth. That's where you end up with that, where it's, well, wait a minute, let's find out what is, not, you know, what my subjective viewpoint is. Let's find out what is, what truth is. That's what we need to get to. I also thought the symbol, the use of terms when they were, the whole Reverend Wright thing came up, and I'm not going to say too much about that because that'll be up later, but just use the term racial stalemate again, it gets described as though this is some sort of brawl between equal combatants, when that is not the case at all. And then the rhetoric really started to pour in when they began talking about Reverend Wright, where I'm just going to read the quote. She's quoting President, or at the time, Senator Obama. "The profound mistake of Reverend Wright's sermons is not that he spoke about racism in our society," Obama said. "It's that he spoke as if our society was static, as if no progress." That is my word. I hate when that word is used in the context of racism, white supremacy. If you have racism, white supremacy, or you do not. Talking about it in degrees, we lynched 10 niggers last year, and we lynched 5 niggers this year, so we have made progress. That is absurd as well. That's standard racism, white supremacy. And the last thing I'll get in is, is it there? Did I read it already? The last thing I'll get in is the sentence, "His pastor's comments," Obama said, lapsing into his harshest language he would use all week, "were stupid. We benefit from the past, from that past," he told me. "We benefit from the difficult battles that were taking place." Just that word, "were," past tense, as though there are no more battles as it relates to racism, white supremacy, taking place right now, again, at the dawn of the Trump era. And I will hush there. If you have other comments that you did not get an opportunity to share, you can just jot a note down. We should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. So we're in Chapter 3, which I think is just titled Barack Obama, it's just titled Barack Obama. How wacky. We're kind of in the midpoint of Chapter 3, right after the Jeremiah Wright thing. We will pick up Context of White Supremacy, Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, audio segment number 2.
Plouffe told me the campaign and the candidate had hoped never to have to give a race speech. The right thing made it more than necessary, and he needed to put that in context, he said. He's obviously running to do big things domestically and internationally, and if the campaign gets defined by, "Are we going to have racial reconciliation or not?" I think a lot of that gets crowded out. The issues he raised in that speech are not essential to his candidacy, Plouffe added. They are essential. They're important problems we're dealing with in this country, but it's not like in August and September and October he's going to keep reprising his speech and offering his candidacy as a way to heal the country. Indeed, just as Plouffe, Axelrod, and the candidate himself planned, Obama never gave a speech exclusively about race again. Barack's candidacy, while he spoke to those issues, it was pitched in a much broader way, Axelrod said after Election Day. He came to this not primarily as the black candidate, but as a candidate for president who happened to be black. It is impossible to overstate how complicated a feat this was to pull off in a nation where the races worship and socialize separately, listen to different music, and watch different television shows. Somehow, instead of becoming a dominant feature of a historic campaign, the divisive issue of race, in Obama's words, "a part of our union that we have yet to perfect," was ultimately reduced to the occasional eruption. Part of the reason this happened is the temperament of the candidate himself. Obama was convinced that focusing the conversation on race in and of itself was a losing argument for a crossover black politician. "I'm sympathetic to efforts to have a racial conversation in this country," he told the National Association of Black Journalists at their summer 2007 convention. "But I find that generally there's a lot of breastbeating and hand-wringing, and then not much follow-through. The kind of conversation I'm interested in having about race is very concrete. Do we have a criminal justice system that is colorblind? If we do not, how do we fix it?" "My belief," he said, "is that African Americans, like other racial minorities in this country, are much more interested in deeds than words, and that's the kind of leadership that I want to show as President of the United States." Obama campaigned in much the same way as he talked to us that day. On one occasion in South Carolina, a black woman stepped forward to tell him that her elderly father was not convinced a black man could win. "If I came to you and I had polka dots," he responded, "but you were convinced that I was going to put more money in your pockets and help you pay for college and help keep America safe, you'd say, 'Okay, you know, I wish you didn't have polka dots, but I'm still voting for him.'" This was sort of revolutionary in the defined world of black politics, appealing to black voters with the same arguments used to convince white ones. This meant setting aside certain articles of faith. For decades, speaking to black voters meant going to Harlem, South Central, the South Side, Liberty City, touchstone black communities, climbing into black pulpits and speaking before black fraternal organizations, saying essentially the same thing over and over again. Obama went to these places, but not as often and with little fanfare. In the past, the way we got out the black voter was always through the grapevine, said Donna Brazil. We knew who had the biggest megaphone. We built them up to talk for us. Now with Obama, it's almost the opposite. We built ourselves up to speak for ourselves. It's transformational. But under the radar, Obama was careful not to completely reject more traditional methods. He devoted a fair share of his time to courting black radio, dialing up influential DJs such as Tom Joyner, Steve Harvey, and Michael Basden, who in turn filled the airwaves with unabashed Obama cheerleading. Most of this was invisible to larger white audiences and the larger white media. This was no accident. Before he gave a version of his tough love speech to an African Methodist Episcopal Church conference in St. Louis last July, he prayed with the denomination's leaders, but backstage, no media allowed. To think clearly about race requires us to see the world on a split screen, Obama wrote after he was elected to the Senate. To maintain in our sight the kind of America that we want while looking squarely at America as it is. I would always get the question, what is Barack Obama's agenda for Black America? Corey Elins, who directed campaign outreach to African American media outlets, told me. I would respond by saying, it's the same as Barack Obama's agenda for all America. Obama's star turn at the 2004 Democratic National Convention arose out of the efforts of a trio of black Democrats, Brazil, Mignon Moore, and Alexis Herman, to lobby for black speakers in prime speaking spots. They called their plan the Barbara Jordan Project, an homage to the Texas congresswoman who delivered a memorable convention keynote in 1976. Obama was just 15 years old at the time, but Jordan's words sounded the themes he would utter from that podium 28 years later. Are we to be one people, bound together by common spirit, sharing in a common endeavor, or will we become a divided nation, she thundered. For all of its uncertainty, we cannot flee the future. It was little noted how much Obama's words in 2004 echoed Jordan's. There is not a liberal America and a conservative America, he said. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and white America and Latino America and Asian America. There is the United States of America. The future, Obama was convinced, could not be painted in black and white. I did not travel around the state over the last year and see a white South Carolina or a black South Carolina, he said in 2008 after trouncing Clinton in the Palmetto State's primary. I saw crumbling schools that are stealing the future of black children and white children. Erasing race had another side benefit. Before he could be taken seriously as a national candidate, Obama had to get conventional wisdom on his side. Since white opinion leaders rarely engaged in race-specific conversations and largely found them uncomfortable, colorblindness was considered a good thing. They were willing to embrace a black man who did not make them feel guilty about race. This conventional wisdom about Barack Obama began forming, as it so often does about rising stars, in Washington, at Georgetown dinner parties and in fussy ballrooms all over the nation's capital, where the city's most self-referentially powerful lawmakers, government officials, and journalists meet to socialize. Membership organizations such as Washington's Gridiron Club are almost entirely white. Until 1974, the journalist group was entirely male as well. How white? The first time I attended one of their annual spring dinners in the mid-1990s, Donna Brazil and I were greeting each other amid the sea of white ties and white skin, happy to discover at least one other African-American in the room. Suddenly, we felt our elbows encased in a firm grasp, and Vernon Jordan leaned in. He was grinning, his teeth very white against his very black skin. "This wasn't what they expected at all," he chortled. We laughed, too. When these clubs were created, we were expected to be serving, not dining. Even now, I'd bet most people in that room possessed not a single black friend, and if they did, it was likely to be Vernon or Donna or me. So it was that much more remarkable when Obama strode onto the dais at the annual dinner in March 2006. It could have been an intimidating evening. The room was filled with movers and shakers of the First Order. But Obama, who had spent a lifetime challenging preconceptions about race, politics, and political timing, seemed entirely at home. He made fun of himself, poked light fun at President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and even sang a little. He was a hit. At some basic, well-concealed level, most politicians and the people who cover politics are idealists. So for that crowd, the idea of Obama was deeply appealing. To white people who consider themselves to be forward-thinking, he was a black man, but not too black. To black people, he was a source of pride, like Tiger Woods, only with a less murky racial identity. Washington, a town that appreciates a good straddle, ate him up with a spoon. That was the night the whispering officially began that he might one day be president. 2 years later, when he was indeed running, Obama made a return visit, this time in absentia, portrayed in one of the evening's mocking skits by an actor dressed like a knight in shining armor. This racial straddle set the stage for what Obama would later accomplish, as he hopscotched from the covers of Ebony, Jet, Essence, and Vibe to GQ, Men's Vogue, and Fast Company. Cover line, the brand called Obama. The key, Michael Eric Dyson said, was for Obama to figure out how to wink at black America while speaking to white America. That's tougher than it sounds. Obama may have won over many liberal whites, at least those not already aligned with Hillary Clinton, but black voters remained skeptical for months, in part because Obama refused to demand support based solely on his breakthrough potential. Roger Wilkins found Obama's racial straddle to be shrewd politics that effectively calls on Americans, he said, to get serious about their nation's founding ideals, including we don't torture people. We don't get involved in wars of choice. We don't get wildly into debt as if the future doesn't count, and we don't ignore global warming because we think scientists are stupid. The racial issue gets subsumed in what he's doing, and that's a good thing. It's very sophisticated, and it's very complex and sensitive. But right now, he's pulling it off. But Obama was not naive. He was well aware that there were voters who would never support him, the ones who bought the waffles and laughed. "I don't believe it is possible to transcend race in this country," he told me one day while he was on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. "The notion that if we just ignore race, somehow our racial problems are solved is the kind of unfortunate thinking the Supreme Court recently engaged in on the Seattle schools case." Obama was referring to a Supreme Court decision that limited the Seattle school district's ability to use race as a factor in promoting integration. "Race is a factor in this society," he said. "The legacy of Jim Crow and slavery has not gone away. It is not an accident that African Americans experience high crime rates, are poor, and have less wealth. It is a direct result of our racial history. We have never fully come to grips with that history." "You just don't walk away from the past," Michelle Obama told me separately. "You bring it along with you. It is always a part of the tradition. You don't move to the next phase without understanding what happened in the civil rights movement." Like many people of their generation, the Obamas operate at something of a remove from that movement, speaking of it with respect, but not with the passion expressed by their elders. Michelle did much more of this than her husband did, and even then much was under the conventional political radar. While campaigning in South Carolina, where the black vote was crucial, she would invoke the names of Coretta Scott King, Harriet Tubman, and Rosa Parks. These were all women who cast aside the voices of doubt and fear that said, "Wait, you can't do that," she said. "It's not your turn. The timing's not right. The country's not ready." She said this to an Orangeburg audience in a speech the campaign circulated to black voters online and on DVD. That gnawing sense of self-doubt that is so common in all of us is a lie. It's a lie, she said, breaking into a preacher's cadence that belied her Princeton and Harvard education. It's just in our heads. See, 9 times out of 10, we are more ready, she said. We are more prepared than we could ever know. Obama saw himself as the bridge between those fears and the possibilities his candidacy represented. Part of what happened in the 60s after the initial civil rights era was we lost some balance, he said, and we started thinking in terms of either or. Either you were picking yourself up by your own bootstraps, you were an integrationist, you were Sidney Poitier, or you were burning down the house. Some of the potholes along the way to the nomination were easily predictable. At a debate with Senator Clinton, Meet the Press moderator Tim Russert asked Obama to denounce Louis Farrakhan. This had become a rite of passage for black politicians because Farrakhan had had unsavory things to say about Jews and white people. Obama toed the mark, denouncing Farrakhan, and when Clinton pressed him to reject Farrakhan as well, Obama shrugged and did that too. There's no formal offer of help from Minister Farrakhan that would involve me rejecting it, he said with ill-concealed disdain. But if the word reject, Senator Clinton feels, is stronger than the word denounce, then I'm happy to concede the point, and I would reject and denounce. Significantly, Farrakhan allowed Obama his straddle. Instead of chastising the candidate for the stiff arm, Farrakhan scolded the questioner for mischief-making. Other black leaders were not as charitable, worrying that the compromises were a red flag about what an Obama presidency would be. Someone said, well, maybe the black candidate can't say that, Oakland Mayor Ron Dellums told me. And I said, I cannot tell you over the last 40 years how many rooms I've been in with white male candidates who said, you know, I love you, but don't make me have to speak to your issues right now. I've got to go get white votes. But once I win, you know I care about you. Trust me. When my hands are under the levers of power, things will change. If a black man was saying this now, Dellums worried, maybe African Americans had not come so far after all. Obama's fiercest critics often came from the left. Princeton Sklod, who early on was one of Obama's most prominent black skeptics, said he was frustrated with the way the nation's first black presidential nominee was handling race. He's supposed to be a transformative figure, Sklod told me. Why is it the case that he can't simply say, when we talk about health care, we know it disproportionately affects poor people and black people? Why can't he begin to talk about these issues in ways that identify black communities without trying to sound like Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton? The thing is, the very way that Jesse and Al have exploited the theater of racial politics, he's doing it from a different vantage point. We haven't changed the game. That's what makes me so angry. He hasn't stepped outside of the game. Perhaps he hadn't, but an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll taken 1 month before Election Day pointed to the reason. 40% of whites and an equal percentage of self-described swing voters declare themselves bothered that, quote, Barack Obama has been supported by African-American leaders such as Reverend Jeremiah Wright and Al Sharpton. This was the backlash risk the Obama campaign had been worried about. In the end, nothing succeeds like success, and most of Obama's black critics were muted, some because they believed political sacrifice was a necessary ingredient for victory. We inherently believe that he's doing what he has to do, Kevin Waterly, a New York political consultant, said. He has to not be in Harlem to get those white votes. Others, however, are playing wait and see. Will the nation's first African-American president deliver? And what does delivering mean anymore if the normal corridors to power are not more readily available to African Americans by virtue of the fact that the man in the Oval Office is black? There is every chance the Moses generation, in ceding the next round to the Joshua generation, may have to adapt to a new definition of success. There is also every evidence that Barack Obama has not transcended race. But his election has provided new proof that he has redefined what racial politics is. Chapter 4, The Race-Gender Clash. I've been a woman my whole life, and every part of me believes in the empowerment of women. But the truth is, I'm a free woman, and being free means you get to think for yourself. Oprah Winfrey. In retrospect, it should have been obvious what was coming. History demanded it. With an African-American man and a woman feuding for the Democratic nomination, the clash between gender and race was as inevitable as it was bound to be messy. Then, shockingly, a woman was added to the Republican ticket late in the process, creating fresh possibilities for making history. Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin had little in common other than their race and gender, but at different periods during the 2008 campaign, their gender appeal managed to present a huge potential challenge for Barack Obama. And during those periods in the spring and the fall, the white men in the race, various Democrats in the spring, John McCain and Joe Biden later on, were thrust to the sidelines. The 2008 presidential campaign, with its potential for breakthrough change in race and gender, was destined to provide the backdrop for unpalatable choices, and Oprah Winfrey turned out to be the test case. No sooner had she announced her public endorsement of Barack Obama early in the year than her website, usually a repository of fawning fandom, exploded with angry recrimination. How could she insert herself into politics, choose to back a man over a woman, choose to support a black man over any woman? Winfrey was dismayed, but she should not have been surprised. Disadvantaged groups, women, racial, and religious minorities, often see their causes in common only when no one is forced to choose among them. This can be tough if one's identity has many roots. When she appeared at UCLA's Pauley Pavilion in the company of Caroline Kennedy, California First Lady Maria Shriver, Stevie Wonder, and Michelle Obama just before the California primary, Winfrey felt compelled to own up to her choice. "I'm not a traitor," she told a cheering crowd with real emotion in her voice. "No, I'm not a traitor. I am just following my own truth. And that truth has led me to Barack Obama." As America's foremost talk show host discovered, the collision of race and gender is a dangerous place. In the closing months of the campaign, it was so disheartening to see the campaign come down to race versus gender, as if who has the greatest disadvantage, said the political activist Donna Brazil. "I felt as a black woman, I was invisible again. I was either black or I was a female. I thought, Jesus, can't I be for both of them?" "We spent precious time debating race versus gender," Brazil told an autumn audience at St. John's University in New York, "as if racism and sexism are not both toxic." Resentments and suspicions long kept under wraps in polite company burst to the surface with alarming regularity throughout this particularly historic campaign. And as Hillary Clinton, the nation's best chance ever to elect a woman president, began to lose ground to Barack Obama, the nation's best chance ever to elect a black president, the corrosive split came into view. But the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who knocked down barriers during the 1980s in races that paved the way for both Clinton and Obama, said he was delighted about what the clash exposed. "Now Barack and Hillary are open field runners," he said. "A healthier, more secure, more mature America is emerging from race and gender shock." Jackson's delight was in general the exception. "Women's liberation didn't lift up black women," wrote Annette John Hall, an African-American columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. "It helped keep them down." Her reasoning, that white women profited disproportionately even from race-conscious remedies such as affirmative action, is a commonly held resentment. After all, though women earn less than men, black women earn the least of all. Lonnie Guinier, the Harvard law professor most famous for being selected, then summarily dropped as a Justice Department nominee in 1993, knows a thing or two about that conflict. "What many observers failed to see," she told me, "was that a good number of African-American women had long hesitated to link their plight to the gender concerns voiced by white women." "You're talking about a group of people who feel very entitled," she said of the white feminists. "They are comparing themselves to white men, and they feel they deserve to be on parity with white men, and they're not. And that's absolutely true. But they're not realizing that black men and black women are so far from parity with white men." Gloria Steinem, the feminist icon, ignited those embers of resentment when she took to the opinion pages of the New York Times just before the New Hampshire primary to declare gender the, quote, most restrictive force in American life. Black men were given the vote a half century before women of any race were allowed to mark a ballot, she wrote, and generally have ascended to positions of power from the military to the boardroom before any women, with the possible exception of obedient family members in the latter. To Steinem and an entire generation of feminists who came of political age in the 1960s and 70s, Obama seemed to be yet another man cutting the line. Her Times article caused an uproar. Who was Steinem to tell folks what side they had to choose? Some raged. Finally, others cheered. Someone said it. Just as America seemed poised to follow Great Britain, Pakistan, India, Germany, Argentina, Israel, and the Philippines into the ranks of great nations with female leaders, along came this upstart ready to ruin everything. Steinem even went on to belittle John McCain, the Republican nominee who spent 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. Suppose John McCain had been Joan McCain, and Joan McCain had got captured, shot down, and been a POW for 8 years, she said to an Austin, Texas audience while campaigning for Clinton. Reporters, she said, would ask the woman, what did you do wrong to get captured? What terrible things did you do while you were there as a captive for 8 years? The Clinton campaign distanced themselves from Steinem on this one, but not from the overall point being made by surrogates speaking on Clinton's behalf all over the country. Geraldine Ferraro described herself as lunatic over the notion that anyone, especially liberals like herself, would consider Obama a better choice than Clinton. Speaking on the radio with conservative talk show host John Gibson, she was out of breath and clearly angry. John, between you and me and your millions of listeners, she raged, if Barack Obama were a white man, would we be talking about him as a potential real problem for Hillary? You mean if he were John Edwards, Gibson interjected? If he were a woman of any color, would he be in this position, she queried, then answered her own question. Absolutely not. Ferraro returned to the sentiment throughout the campaign, ratcheting up her accusations each time. At one point, she even told a small Torrance, California newspaper that Obama was lucky to be black because America was, quote, caught up in the concept. Obama branded the assertion ridiculous, and the Clinton campaign had Ferraro step down from her official campaign role. Such arguments echoed more loudly as Clinton's once inevitable march to the Democratic nomination began to falter. Voters anxious to make history, it seemed, had a choice of the kind of history they would make in 2008. Alice Eccles, a gender studies professor at the University of Southern California, described the explosion of support for Obama as the Prius factor. Obama supporters can feel self-congratulatory about striking a blow against racism in the way that Prius drivers can feel they're striking a blow for energy responsibility and independence, she said. Striking a blow against sexism and feeling good about it has not figured nearly as much in this campaign. Robin Morgan, the author of the 1970 feminist manifesto, Sisterhood is Powerful, sounded another battle cry in an email that whipped around the pro-Hillary feminist community. Not since suffrage have two communities, joint conscience keepers of this country, been so set in competition, she wrote, her words laced with outrage, in a complaint that would become common among Clinton supporters as Obama started winning. She decried the toxic viciousness, news coverage target practices, and ageism she saw all around her. Goodbye to turning him into a shining knight when actually he's an astute, smooth Paul, she wrote. Obama, she and others declaimed, was poised to win the nomination for no other reason than that he was a man. The backlash, turning Obama from a shining knight into a greedy male, worked for Clinton among some segments of women voters. Even after Obama sealed up the nomination and moved toward the general election, resentments festered. Republicans watched closely, and even Sarah Palin moved quickly to exploit some of the lingering hurt feelings. I can't begin this great effort, she said on the day McCain selected her as his running mate, without honoring the achievements of Geraldine Ferraro back in 1984, and of course Senator Hillary Clinton, who did show determination and grace in her presidential campaign. When Palin appeared on the scene, white women were among the first to jump off the Obama bandwagon in a shocking 20-point swing from the Obama-Biden ticket to the McCain-Palin ticket within days after the Republican convention. Within 48 hours of Palin's surprise pick, all high-profile Republican women were dispatched to call attention to what they saw as a double standard in news coverage. Carly Fiorina, the former chairman and CEO of Hewlett-Packard and a senior advisor to McCain, went on Sunday morning television to declare Obama had made a critical strategic error in not selecting Hillary Clinton as his running mate. "There are a whole host of women in the Democratic Party," she told George Stephanopoulos, "who believe the Democratic Party does not understand what sexism is, routinely underestimates the impact of women. And they are coming in droves to the Republican Party because they think the party and John McCain get it." The shock, we now know, did not last. By early October, Palin's gains among women and independent voters had almost entirely disappeared. Claiming a double standard soon fizzled, too. Palin complained that the news media held her to a double standard on matters of wardrobe and conduct, but exit polls showed women either had little sympathy for that argument or had little sympathy for John McCain. Obama won among women voters, 56% to 43%. During the Democratic primary campaign, the Obama-Clinton conflict morphed from rough competition to brutal political deathmatch. Clinton learned how to periodically tap into the anger expressed by the feminists, as well as the discomfort bubbling under the surface among women who did not consider themselves particularly radical. She won the New Hampshire primary, for instance, on the strength of the female vote, after she grew misty-eyed when asked a sympathetic question the day before voters went to the polls. But the Clinton campaign also targeted female voters with effective direct mail appeals as well. By the time Obama wrapped up the Democratic nomination in late spring, white women viewed him unfavorably, 49% to 43%. Republicans noted that, too. There was indeed plenty of anecdotal evidence to support the notion that gender, not race, was the greater disadvantage in this campaign. Noisy protesters at one Clinton event in New Hampshire interrupted the candidate, shouting, "Iron my shirt!" Airport gift shops tastelessly stocked Hillary Clinton nutcrackers with what appeared to be stainless steel thighs. And one unusually candid blue-collar worker in Youngstown, Ohio, told a white male reporter for the Wall Street Journal that while no one wanted to attack Obama for fear of being called a racist, quote, "It's easier to say you want to keep a woman barefoot and pregnant. You can call a woman anything." And this was a Clinton supporter. Even Elton John, who raised $2.5 million for Clinton at a New York fundraiser when she was scraping to pay the health care costs of her campaign workers, railed against sexism in politics, saying he was amazed by the misogynistic attitudes of some of the people in this country. This created something of a straitjacket for Clinton, who, much like Obama, hoped to benefit from her history-making potential without necessarily having to call overt attention to it herself. But as Clinton began to grasp for every remaining vote in states she had to win, she was happy to declare that sexism, not racism, had the more debilitating effect. But which really helped or hurt more, race or gender? In exit poll after exit poll during the primaries, voters who said race mattered voted against Obama, while voters who said gender mattered voted for Clinton. In a conservative state such as Kentucky, where Clinton hoped to do well, more than one in five voters in the pre-election survey viewed Obama's race as a negative. When asked about gender, however, 63% said it didn't matter, and 11% say they viewed it as a positive. Remarkably, Obama lost primaries in states like this, but overcame the drag his race would have been expected to present in many others. Still, many of Clinton's most fervent female supporters grew convinced over time that misogyny, not a mismanaged campaign or Obama's appeal, was at the root of their candidate's failure. Some women seized on a moment when Obama, speaking to a female reporter backstage after a speech in Detroit, referred to her in an offhand fashion as sweetie, He called a reporter later that day to apologize and granted her a formal interview a few weeks later. Like many other successful politicians, Clinton often blamed the news media, telling one sympathetic female Washington Post reporter that it was clearly more acceptable to take pot shots based on gender. It does seem as though the press at least is not as bothered by the incredible vitriol that has been engendered by the comments by people who are nothing but misogynists, she said. As the campaign wore on, another chasm opened. Clinton retained her edge with white women while black women continued shifting to Obama, giving him in many states the majority overall of the female vote. In South Carolina, white women voted for Clinton by nearly 2-1, while black women chose Obama at nearly twice that rate. In Pennsylvania, 19% of those who voted said the gender of the candidate helped determine their vote. Of those, a whopping 71% voted for Clinton. It should be noted that an equal number cited race as a factor, but most of them voted against Obama. Within weeks, Clinton supporters were buying full-page newspaper ads and staging noisy protests outside Democratic Party meetings to declare that sexism was driving Clinton from the race. They were incensed again when NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, broke ranks to endorse Obama. Clinton's campaign was run by longtime aides Patty Solis Doyle, a Latina, and then by Maggie Williams, who is black. For months, they resisted playing the race versus gender card. Early polls, in fact, showed Clinton beating Obama among black women, 47% to 37%. But once Obama began winning, black women flipped, and as the overall gender chasm grew, old wounds between black women and white women surged back into view. Writing for the Black Affairs website, TheRoot.com, Princeton professor and Obama supporter Melissa Harris-Lacewell declared that black women were ready to reject what she called, quote, Hillary's Scarlet O'Hara Act. Throughout history, privileged white women attached at the hip to their husbands' power and influence, she wrote, have been complicit in black women's oppression. Many African-American women are simply refusing to play mammy to Hillary. The truth is, black women have always resented being asked to choose allegiance between gender and race. Alice Walker, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple, also chose the cyber pages of TheRoot.com to write of her disappointment at the growing conflict, her, quote, deep sadness that many of my feminist white women friends cannot see Obama, that they can believe that millions of Americans, black, white, yellow, red, and brown, choose Obama over Clinton only because he is a man and black, feels tragic to me. Imagine if he wins the presidency. We will not have one but three black women in the White House, she said, referring to Michelle Obama and the couple's daughters, Malia and Sasha. One tall, two somewhat shorter, none of them carrying the washing in and out of the back door. The flip side of the argument came from an older white woman, an expert in the field of gender politics, who bemoaned to me, as Clinton's campaign was winding down, that Obama's success meant that she would never get to dance at the inauguration of a female president. This proved to be an enduring grievance that dogged Obama throughout the campaign, and that, for a time, turned the Democratic nominating convention into as much a celebration of Clinton's gender breakthrough as of Obama's racial one. After Clinton was defeated, it took some time for her most ardent supporters to embrace Obama. In another widely circulated email making the rounds shortly after Obama clinched the nomination, Tim Wise, a liberal white writer, penned an open letter to white women. Among other things, he asserted that white female Democrats contemplating a vote for Republican John McCain were engaging in, quote, white racial bonding. Needless to say, he wrote, it is high irony bordering on the outright farcical to believe that electorally bonding with white men so as to elect McCain is a rational strategy for promoting feminism and challenging patriarchy. You are not thinking and acting as women, but as white people. So here's the first question. What the hell is that about? What it was about, some academics pointed out, was a struggle for two historically disadvantaged groups to grab for the same brass ring at precisely the same moment. What we are seeing now is a new racial regime where blacks can play on any stage and women can play on any stage, said John A. Powell, the executive director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. It's just not going to be on the same stage. Democratic men, meanwhile, were slowly moving toward Obama. His edge among men of all races increased by 40 points during the primary season, while Clinton's male support dropped from 42% to 28% between December and February. Clinton's most steadfast support came from white female and working-class voters, so she and her husband Bill created a survival strategy that required her to deftly negotiate a minefield of racial politics. But their effort often came across as divisive at worst, condescending at best. When a deadlocked election seemed to threaten her nomination chances, she began telling audiences in Obama-leaning Mississippi that they might be able to vote for him as vice president on her ticket. This was a particularly bold prediction since at the time she was trailing him in popular votes and pledged delegates. Blacks aren't going to sit back while the winning candidate is told to sit at the back of the bus, the Reverend Eugene Rivers of Boston's Azusa Christian Community said. All of these feints conspire to drive the race-gender wedge even deeper. Betsy Reed, the executive editor of the liberal magazine The Nation, wrote that the race versus gender debate was, quote, a clarifying moment as well as a wrenching one, in part because while sexism was often on more open display, racism, which is often coded, is more insidious and trickier to confront. Reed's contention was backed by an unpublished study on unconscious bias in elections that concluded gender matters in politics, but it matters less than race. But, the study authors noted, implicit bias, the kind most people do not admit to, made running for president a tough hill to climb for both Obama and Clinton. Each struggled to create a path through that obstacle course. Every so often, I just wish that it were a little more of an even playing field, Clinton told ABC's Cynthia McFadden, invoking an analogy often employed in debates about affirmative action. But, you know, I play on whatever field is out there. Clinton was uncommonly good at turning her gender into an advantage whenever it helped, once laughing off a Rush Limbaugh criticism by suggesting he'd always had a crush on her. But she also never hesitated to complain about gender's disadvantages, a claim Palin was later quick to embrace as well. Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, says many women were troubled when Obama's shooting star eclipsed Clinton's, especially since Clinton had taken him under her wing when he arrived in the U.S. Senate. Here you are, she said, the bright, intelligent person in the workplace, and you basically train this new young man, and he gets promoted over you. Bystrom and others also see echoes of past resentments in the recurring race-gender clash. When the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified in 1870, black men were granted the right to vote, but women were not. That did not happen until the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920, after 72 years of agitation. There was also this sort of racial undertone in the women's suffrage movement, Bystrom said. I kind of wonder sometimes, are we seeing the same types of issues in this current campaign? Left unexplored were some of the hard facts. White women never had any problem exercising their hard-won franchise. Black men certainly did. Sharon Sales Belton, an Obama supporter and former mayor of Minneapolis, watched the gender clash carefully from the sidelines. Although she was her city's first black mayor, she got the job after she was recruited to run by women's activists, most of them white. This year, she said, she was astonished when Clinton supporters she knew would tell her they might support McCain instead. I told them, you're crazy. You're out of your mind, she said to me. Excuse me, how dense are you? I had to hit them on the head. The politics of gender especially caught fire whenever powerful men began to apply political pressure. When Obama supporters such as Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson began to call for Clinton to abandon her campaign, many of her supporters, including her husband Bill, began accusing the boys of bullying the girl to drop out. Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinoki even complained that the media were characterizing Clinton's female supporters as cranks who refused to accept defeat. And when Joe Biden prepared to debate Palin, all anyone wanted to know was whether he would be able to face her down without giving off an odor of condescension. Some of this gender-based analysis ignored a home truth that undercut both Clinton's and Palin's core appeal. Women do not operate as a voting bloc. Carol Hardy Fanta, the director of the Center for Women in Politics and Policy at the University of Massachusetts Boston, told me, "Women, feminist movement people, would like to see women unify around a woman candidate because a woman should be elected. That doesn't exist. Despite the op-eds that have been written in Gloria Steinem and all these other people, it doesn't exist." Widely covered bitterness in the wake of Clinton's defeat in the primaries, pollsters from NBC News and the Wall Street Journal discovered Obama had opened a 19-point lead among all women over Republican John McCain. In 2004, John Kerry beat George W. Bush among women by only 3 points. So Obama's performance among women, after having defeated a historic female candidate, was actually an improvement. And in the end, Palin's appearance on the GOP ticket did not help close the Democrats' post-Hillary advantage, so much for the enduring gender divide. Another critical factor was often overlooked in the race versus gender analysis. The generational split may have played a larger role in exacerbating, or Obama backers might argue, erasing, the race-gender divide. Diane Bystrom at Iowa State noticed that young women, in particular, did not necessarily consider it a test of sisterhood to embrace 61-year-old Hillary Clinton. As one of my students said, "I really like Hillary Clinton, but she reminds me of my mother." For every aggrieved white woman for Hillary, there popped up a famous white or black or Latina woman who opted for the black man, including women such as Caroline Kennedy and Senator Claire McCaskill, who said their children talked them into supporting Obama. I asked Obama about all this during a spring 2007 conversation. Was Senator Clinton right when she said her victory would be shattering the highest and hardest glass ceiling? He smiled as if acknowledging the understatement to come. "Oh, you know, I would say it would be pretty significant if we had an African-American president." The smile turned into a chuckle, but he backed away from the rhetorical trap I'd laid. "You know, I don't want to get into a contest in terms of which would be more significant. I think either one would be significant. So ultimately, the question for the American people is, who do they think is best equipped to actually solve the problems that we face right now? And if you as a voter, regardless of your race or gender, decide that it's Senator Clinton, then you should vote for Senator Clinton. If it's me, you should vote for me."
And that will do it for this week's session. We are in Chapter 4. This is where we'll pick up at for next Friday. Make sure I pause. George Curry was mentioned in the text this week. He also passed. Was an unpleasant year on the whole, but we lost some very important black journalists. Mr. George Curry, Gwen Ifill. Context of White Supremacy. If folks would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open. Please do not wait till the last minute. We should have ample time for everybody to share. Just don't wait. If you think you have something to share, go ahead and get a hand up now. All the folks who have a hand up, your line is open. Let's
not.
Yes, sir.
Okay. One of the things that they were talking about the debate when they were trying to get Obama to, I guess, vehemently denounce Farrakhan. You know, it's that old adage that, you know, white people love to see black people fighting each other. So I don't know what they were expecting Obama to say, you know, outside of calling him, you know, whatever out of his name. But I guess that's what they were expecting, you know, him to do. So you know, white people, you know, love to see two niggers fight. So, you know, that's the nothing new. The chapter on feminism is a very interesting chapter. I like the interesting one was the example of Oprah. You know, she had always been one of the, you know, forefront supporters of feminism, but you can see that when she supported Obama, you saw the racism come out of the white feminist movement and how, you know, how it was a prime example of how the feminist movement is racist and has always been, you know, a racist movement because it's always been controlled by white women. So, you know, Oprah being ostracized by the feminist movement just, you know, by supporting Obama. It was funny, Clinton, you know, how Hillary Clinton blamed the news media for her loss, but she doesn't talk about the news media and how the news media was favoring her in this election, but she still ended up losing to Trump. And I'm pretty sure you all got a kick out of the Tim Wise comments, but I will just leave it from there and I will mute my line.
Tim Wise was mentioned? Really? Other folks who have commentary, feel free. Let us not dally. We don't like that. Wait until the last minute. Everybody who has the caller. Yes, sir, but we have a new person. The caller at 7722. I don't think we heard from you at all. 7722. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Thank you. Greetings to callers and the host. Yes, I especially felt compelled to comment on this section on white women. I will never miss an opportunity to give my comments. They have caused me an especial amount of confusion and pain in my short lifetime. I do think it was very interesting, the comments that were made by this white liberal writer, Tim Wise. I thought that was, I laughed quite a bit to myself there. Claire McCaskill, she is a senator from the state which I live. I'm from Missouri. And it's interesting that she said that her children convinced her to vote. They talked her into voting for Barack Obama. It's extremely interesting. Just white supremacy where children can convince parents like, oh yeah, mommy, daddy, let's choose the black guy because that's, you know, that's what we do now. Blatant racist operating there. Geraldine Ferraro, wicked, in my opinion, very wicked woman. The comments that she was making about Obama, specifically, you know, for Clinton, she is no longer living, but I believe her actions extremely showing how, again, white women are, you know, and sometimes I even question whether white supremacy will exist if white women were gone and white men were only here because of the very deceptive influence of white women in the system. The feminism movement, again, in the front for white supremacy. I noticed that specifically when she was speaking about how whenever, you know, of course, Oprah Winfrey having to almost cry in front of her audience. And we know what white women meant to Oprah. And seeing Oprah have to almost beg them, tell them that she's not a traitor, again, the very vicious, vicious attack of white women, very, very integral components of the system of white supremacy. I'll leave my comment line. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Roz, thank you for your patience. Were you going to comment, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Previous caller, brilliant observation. White women, I think, are the linchpin in white supremacy. They are the ones who really wear the pants, in my opinion. They're highly, highly deceptive. Geraldine Ferraro is a snake, and I'm pretty glad she's dead, in my opinion. I have no love for her whatsoever. She's a beast. But to get to the text itself, there was a paragraph she wrote that I found Mrs. Zeifel wrote that I found very telling. She said, erasing race had another side benefit. Before he could be taken seriously as a national candidate, Obama had to get conventional wisdom on his side. since white opinion leaders rarely engage in race-specific conversations and largely found them uncomfortable, color blindness was considered a good thing, whatever that means. They were willing to embrace a black man who did not make them feel guilty about race. And that, to me, was a big, one of the biggest parts of President Obama's campaign, was not offending white people. And that is just the system of white supremacy. You know, as a non-white person, and especially if you're a black person, the last thing you want to do is offend white people, because your career will stop just that fast. And obviously he understood that. And a lot of this, to me, this text is just bringing home, in my mind, the fact that he was groomed for that position and that he was selected, not necessarily voted in. As all the presidents, so I don't believe any of them are voted in, they're selected, and they make the choices behind the scenes. The Electoral College follows through with what they're told to do, and whoever they choose to, you know, is going to be the next so-called leader of the free world, per se, whatever that means, that's what happens. She also wrote, let me see, oh, yes, this one's really mind-blowing. She wrote, our membership organizations such as Washington's Gridiron Club are almost entirely white. Until 1974, the journalist group was entirely male as well. How white? The first time I attended one of their annual spring dinners in the mid-1990s, Donna Brazile and I were greeting each other amid the sea of white ties and white skin, happy to discover at least one other African-American in the room. Suddenly, we felt our elbows encased in a firm grip, and Vernon Jordan leaned in. He was grinning, his teeth very white against his very black skin. This isn't what they expected at all, he chortled. We laughed, too. When these clubs were created, we were expected to be serving, not dining. Even now, I bet most would be, excuse me, even now, I bet, I lost my place. Oh, yeah, I did lose my place. Oh, and if they did, it was likely to be Vernon or Donna or me. And I just, that sounded like a lynch party to me. It was I would not have been there without a gun on the waist, period. That's just, I would not walk into a situation like that without a gun on my waist, period. So that was just a really interesting reading. And for black people who work in politics, who are journalists and have to be in those sort of terroristic settings, I just, I feel for them, because that is just horrific. And I'm sure the epigenetics really skyrockets in those kind of situations. I found one thing that she wrote really telling was a paragraph down, further down. She says, at some basic, well-conceived level, most politicians and the people who cover politics are idealists. So for that crowd, the idea of Obama was deeply appealing. To white people who considered themselves to be forward-thinking, he was a black man, but not too black. To black people, he was a source of pride. Like Tiger Woods, only with a less murky racial identity. I found that metaphor less murky. So I guess because Tiger Woods is Asian and black, his identity is more murky than Obama, who has a white mother and an African father. I just found that just to be a very telling metaphor. And even when she alluded to the fact that he was not too black, that also speaks to the system of white supremacy as well, and the fact that the lighter you are, the more acceptable you are to the people in control, which are white people. Also, lastly, I wanted to touch on, there was another paragraph where she wrote, some of the potholes along the way to the nomination were easily predictable. At a debate with Senator Clinton, Meet the Press moderator Tim Russert asked Obama to denounce Louis Farrakhan. This had become a rite of passage for black politicians because Farrakhan had unsavory things to say about Jews and white people. Obama toed the mark, denouncing Farrakhan, and when Clinton pressed him to reject Farrakhan as well, Obama shrugged and did that too. And this is telling you right there, even before, during, on the campaign trail, that he understood Clinton's power. I was blown away in regards to how hard he was stumping for her on her attempt to go to the White House after all that she had said and done to him. And to me, him stumping for her after the vitriol she spewed about him on the campaign trail when he was running for president speaks volumes to his understanding of her power. And this paragraph where she was able to tell him, like he was a slave on the plantation, what to do, and he, like she, well, she used the term, towed the line. He just did whatever she said because he understood that white power is the power that you kowtow to if you're trying to do anything of substance in this society as far as the way that the system views what black people are allowed to accomplish. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you. I'll meet my line for now.
Wow. Said he would take it personal if we didn't get out, if black people didn't get out there and vote for Clinton. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free. We miss anybody? Anybody that had a hand up that we have not heard from at all during
Hello,
the second?
Hello, I can be heard.
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Hey, how everybody doing, man? I just wanted to kind of like, back to what Ron was saying. Like, I remember when Clinton and Obama were running, man, and she was, she was doing a whole lot of bad talking about this man and everything, and then he jumped out there. And so it kind of made me wonder, like, how do the politics really work? Is it, some of us think it's rigged and already put together who's going to win or whatever. But then when you look at, the way she handled that, it kind of makes me think different. But I noticed how that lady keep using that word straddle. She like to use that word straddle a lot. I know you mentioned something about that last week. And here she goes use about four times tonight. And there's something else I was gonna talk about, but that's probably it right there, man. I just wanted to touch on that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The word straddle, I have the Kindle on this too, so you can word count. The word straddle is in the book 11 times, equal number of times as the word racism, for what it's worth. Anybody else that we missed who has not shared at all? Everybody satisfied? I guess everybody who wanted to comment has spoken.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just have a quick question. She said about the brass ring, and it made me think of Lord of the Rings. So I'm thinking this might be some kind of, I don't know, I don't want to just say like pop culture thing, but like a metaphor that's in something that I don't know. Does someone out there know where this brass ring that's like making its way into pop culture or into metaphoric language is coming from?
I think I've heard that type of metaphor. It's not always brass, but just some sort of a ring being used as what people are chasing in terms of the ring being the presidency. I've heard that used in other, whether it's some sort of competition, whether it's a political office or if it's a sporting competition, I've heard that metaphor invoked a lot. I don't know what the origin of it is. And like I said, sometimes it has brass there, sometimes it does not. But I think it's been going for a long, long time, this notion of the brass ring is the prize that everybody's chasing.
Okay, thank you.
If anybody finds out any better, more accurate information, that'd be great as well. Did we miss anybody? Got everybody? Grant, I will see what I can get in before we get ready to wrap things up. I had to sit through Tim Wise this week. Amazing, amazing, amazing. Okay, so some of the notes that I took from this week. Donna Brazile has been mentioned quite a bit. I just posted the article where they blamed her. She got yelled at by some white woman, no doubt, because Hillary Clinton's lost to Donald Trump in this past election. Let's see. The next thing. When the portion where they talk about what is Barack Obama's agenda for Black America, this act of straddling, and they say he would respond that, Barack Obama's agenda is for all America. Ta-Nehisi Coates, who we also have read in our book club, I think he has a great assessment. And he brought it out again this presidential election cycle when the big to-do came
Bernie Sanders was asked about reparations. He said no, he would not support it. And Ta-Nehisi Coates said that he rejects this notion of we can just put in policies that do not explicitly mention racism, white supremacy, and think that that's going to solve this problem when you had very deliberate, explicitly racist policies that have led us to this point, to then think that you can solve all of that without being deliberate in addressing that this is what we are trying to address and end and then compensate, solve all the problems that this created, that that is nonsense, that you cannot do it without honestly addressing that, which I totally agree with. It's just I conclude that whites have no interest. They're not going to do that at all. They just continue with the practice of white supremacy. There was a mention of South Carolina on this week when Dawn Storm Roof was convicted. That portion where she talks about the press gala, and she says that when they were at this gala, I guess it was her and Vernon Jordan, and it was one more black journalist. I'm missing one. The Gridiron Club, Washington's Gridiron Club. It was Donna Brazil. She's not a journalist. She's with the Democratic Party, and Vernon Jordan. When she said that Vernon Jordan, he was grinning, his teeth very white against his very black skin, that just stood out. It just stood out as being a tad peculiar to hear it described in that way. But moving forward, I also wanted to make sure I got in Gus T. Renegade. I do not want white people to have black, quote-unquote, friends. That is horrendous. I don't think that that is a sign of progress or us moving towards solving this problem. Let's see. She has this passage where she says, to white people who consider themselves to be forward-thinking, Obama was a black man, but not too black. I'm just contrasting that with the earlier paragraph where she was quoting Michael Eric Dyson talking about President Obama appreciating his blackness. Let's see. The next thing, Washington, a town that appreciates a good straddle, ate Obama up with a spoon. Delectable Negro immediately came to mind. and the very next highlight that I have, the racial straddle set the stage for what Obama would later accomplish as he hopscotched from the covers of Ebony, Jet, Essence, and Vibe to GQ, Men's Vogue, and Fast Company. To me, that says that some very powerful white people were behind President Obama very early on to get him on those types of publications so that everybody will say, oh, okay, this guy is all right, this Obama guy, to get that type of coverage. They didn't do that for Daniel Holtzclaw and the black females who were raped in Oklahoma City, 2014. Next thing I had, black friend, got that. She did it again, Shear. She says Obama's fiercest critics often came from the left, and she immediately mentions a black person, Princeton professor Claude, who she says was one of the early skeptics of President Obama. I contend it is massively incorrect. If we're going to present the story of President Obama at any point along the way, while he was in office, while he was running, and his staunchest critics, some of his most ferocious obstacles were black people in a system of white supremacy. Do you all, and I was waiting, maybe it's in here, and she just didn't mention it. I was waiting. Do you all remember when Hillary Clinton said that, after President Obama got the nomination, that she was going to hang in there because he might get assassinated? Like, those types of remarks being made, and it's people like Professor Claude and others, those are the biggest obstacles. That just strikes me as being, as I stated, massively, massively incorrect. When she's talking about black females and them not supporting the feminist movement that was happening around Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008, I thought the word resentment, where she says, I'll give you the full sentence, she says, a commonly held it helped keep them down, where she's talking about feminism keeping down black females. She's quoting Annette John Hall, a black female professor. She says her reasoning that white women profited disproportionately from Even race-conscious remedies such as affirmative action is a commonly held resentment. I thought that's not the correct word. That is truth. White women have benefited more from affirmative action. That is fact. And so if a black person is upset about that, I mean, right on, you should be. And that's just further evidence of racism, white supremacy. I pay particular attention because consistently black people, when we report that we are being terrorized economically, physically, all areas of people activity, it just gets talked up to a grievance. Or you're just a little child and you just have some sort of resentment and your feelings are hurt. And I mean, that is infantilizing. I think we talked about that concept before. That is infantilizing. And it's totally an act of racism, white supremacy, and just minimizing. This is the legitimate evidence of the terrorism that we're being subjected to. Let's see. I will get in like maybe one or two more. Did anybody have any other comments? Just make sure we didn't miss any other comments. Folks are good. No other comments. Everybody's good. Grant, I'll get in my last two and we will get ready to wrap. Let's see. I thought the commentary where she's quoting Gloria Steinem and all these other whites who were commenting in 2008, I so wish that I had been paying more attention to the system of racism, white supremacy throughout the campaign. This was like just when we got thrown off the air at the end of 2007, so we were not on the air in 2008. I really wish I had seen some of this commentary at that time to point out the role of white women for Gloria Steinem to come out and say, oh my God, the scourge of sexism, and you got these black males and you're letting them vote way before women were allowed to. But it's like, ho. You mean allowing black males ostensibly to vote and then coming and terrorizing them so that they're not able to do so? And we'll lynch a whole town if you even look like you're trying to come and vote. That's what you're talking. I mean, that sort of just flagrant deception where they just get to come out and totally lie. And then it's the same thing, white victimhood. And it's been a lot of that this week, too, even this week at the Dylann Roof trial. But white victimhood. White women are great at that. White men are pretty phenomenal as well. But it was just astounding to go through and hear. So Gus got disconnected. I lost my internet signal as I was attempting to finish my last few remarks and close out the broadcast. So I'm still going to, there was no way that Gus was going to allow this broadcast to end without me being able to get in my sentence about Tim Wise. But I was saying, I feel like just the inaccuracies that were presented in the testimony about black males being able to vote sooner, it would be glorifying it to say that it was revisionist history, that these folks are just being able to come out. I mean, it's not even fake news. I mean, this is just flagrant white women practicing racism, white supremacy, and I wish I had paid attention to this when it was happening. I thought it was important. Carly Fiorini, she was mentioned. Donald Trump, just today, Donald Trump is looking at her for a possible position in his new administration. So eye on that. I think a position with national intelligence. So something to keep an eye on as well moving forward. I think, let's see, before, other than the Tim Wise piece, what else did I? The Melissa Harris Lacewell is now Melissa Harris Perry. I thought her commentary where she was critiquing, where she used the metaphor of Hillary's Scarlett O'Hara Act in terms of soliciting black female support. Hillary Clinton still did get a pretty sizable amount of black female and male support in this year, 2016. And there were a lot of articles talking about how that was the backbone of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. I thought the commentary from Alice Walker, that would be a cowbell, was interesting as well, where it said Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple, also chose the cyber pages of theroot.com to write her disappointment at the growing conflict her deep sadness that many of my feminist white women friends, that word again, white friends, cannot see Obama. They can believe that millions of Americans, black, white, yellow, red, and brown, chose Obama over Clinton only because he is a man and black, feels tragic to me. I think a lot of times when we have those close, intimate relationships with white people, it really makes it hard because we have those emotional ties. She was a lot of emotion about this, feeling sad, seeing her white friends, in my opinion, practice racism. Let's see. Anything else before I get to my Tim Wise comment? I think I can get to my Tim Wise comment and then we'll wrap things and be great to hear from folks next week. Everybody back with us and hopefully no tech issues. The Tim Wise commentary, where she solicits, she does not cite him as being an admitted racist, which he admitted on this broadcast in the winter of 2010. She lists him as being this liberal white man who is, you know, giving his view and really chiding white women, pointing out their racism. If anybody would like this article, I can dig online and find it. I did have some misgivings about, you know, we're supposed to be trying to put him out of business, but if anyone wanted to check it out. But the thing, we could just go to the same critique that I've had of Gwen Ifill, people not being accurate when they present about racism, white supremacy. Wise writes, needless to say, it is high irony bordering on the outright farcical to believe that electorally bonding with white men so as to elect McCain is a rational strategy for promoting feminism and challenging patriarchy. You are not thinking and acting as women, but as white people. And I thought that was the error right there. It's not thinking and acting as white people. You are thinking and acting as white supremacists. That's what it should be said. This is not white privilege. This is white supremacy. Hugely important. And just again, in my view, this is the problem where Timothy Wise, this is a best-selling book that we are reading. Gwen Ifill is held in high regard. She should be, even though in this book, I strongly state that we are not getting an accurate presentation of racism, white supremacy. That notwithstanding, Gwen Ifill is held in high regard. To have someone like Gwen Ifill write in a New York Times bestseller, quoting Timothy Wise, where he gets to be seen as, wow, this is a white man that gets it. Wow. If we could just get more like him he understands. See, he's not, that's exactly what I've heard from victims of racism. It's so powerful when other non-white people, when we cite these whites as, this is an example of a white, I cite white people. I do it all the time. However, when I'm verbally on the program and even in my written discourse, I make an effort to cite out, this is a suspected racist. It's not just going to be, oh yeah, I'm citing this white person is cool, they're great, whatever. Even Dr. Martin Kevorkian, I said on the program, he is an admitted white supremacist. I've written it in descriptions when he's come on the program, whole nine. That cannot be lost. When we put our thoughts out there, it can lend an unwarranted credibility where non-white people see this and think that this person is legit, not racist, and in fact, pretty darn informed about racism. And I'm going to go buy a few of his books and check out his blog right now. That ends up what happening. It ends up not just being a Tim Wise thing. It ends up being that there are other white people that are trustworthy, or we can give them a chance or coach them along and they can be redeemed. And again, nothing is further from the truth. You can go back in the archives and hear some of the broadcasts with the infamous Timothy Wise to hear some of our exchanges. With that, we will conclude the program. Again, the tech issues, the last few minutes, we didn't have the rest of the callers with us. My apologies to everyone who dialed in. It was great hearing from everyone, and hopefully next week we'll have no problems with the broadcast. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, Saturday, for the compensatory call-in, Sunday for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, White Supremacy. The Saturday program, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. Sunday broadcast is early, Sunday, 18th of December. We're on at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Tune in on Sunday. We'll be looking forward to speaking with our international audience. With that, thanks to everyone tuning into the broadcast. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.